Czech Republic to see that the significance of Central Europe for U.S. will be priority number one, no one is expecting that. But on the other hand, for us, in the space between Germany and Russia, it has been always welcomed if there are other outside influences and if, in particular, U.S. is present in Central Europe. As was said by Radek, the U.S. presence in Central Europe has been declining and has been declining over the years. Of course, it's been relative because of the influence of the European investment and trade and the internal European Union structures. It has been also nominal. The U.S. energy companies have left years ago. It can be hardly mentioned that there is any U.S. strategic investment, and I don't consider the car manufacturing as strategic. We do not see that many trends what would be really rooted there. On the other hand, I would argue that not that for U.S. the region would be priority number one, but it should be somewhere on the list of the priorities, the presence in Central Europe. Also with the view of the relations with the European Union as such. As was also already mentioned, the Nirvana will be there by the 1st of December in the European Union. The Lisbon Treaty will enter into force and EU will be very reformed. It's going to be a brand new situation. But I think that it is for the U.S. very important that it works not only with Berlin, Paris and London in the long term, but that it takes very many other differences and other actors and significant and less significant countries in terms of the economy, in terms of the military strength and in terms of the internal Brussels debate. So I think that if everything is going to be from Washington seen only through the debates, through be it Brussels, but then through the three major capitals, I don't know if it's going to be easier for U.S. to push for its interests. I do think that there is still a chance that the drift will not be extremely deep, definitely it is for more thinking here in Washington. And also it will be more seen of exactly how the Lisbon Treaty and how the system in European Union will work after the 1st of December. There is a lot of unknowns, and it will take some precedence and some real internal battles of how the system is then established and what is the equilibrium inside. Just to mention the reasons for the decision of the Czech government to engage in the talks on the missile defense. The reason was not primarily a military reason, but it was a reason to see that if there is could be some strategic component in Central Europe behind the old NATO borders, then it could be this one. So we did welcome it that it could be something which would be on the ground. It's not going to happen. We will see what's going to be exactly the future, but that is, again, the example of not seeing exactly 100% the U.S. presence in the region in anything what you can really touch and how it's going to be seen from within the region as well as from outside of the region. I think that it would be naive to think that we would return to the prominence and significance of Central Europe in the 90s. But I think that it would be a mistake to be neglecting it, but not from the point of view that U.S. Should be aiding the new democracies and our economies, but I think it's a real time to find out what are exactly the areas for mutual beneficial cooperation. And again, I think that there are some areas that it should be looked from this perspective. I do see that there are some problems, as were mentioned by Kurt, in Central Europe. But I did read in the newspapers about some corruption charges, not in Central Europe, but in the Western Europe. I did see some other tensions, not in the suburbs of Prague and Warsaw, but in the suburbs of some other larger European and West European cities. And I think that it should be looked really carefully into the EU and the member states and seeing the differences and basically get over this divide of the old and new Europe. Because the divides in the economic performance, the divides in the political performance, in the strategies of the governments are very much different. And I think that we can guarantee that in 10 years those coalitions, and we do see them even now, once talking in Brussels on many issues and internal issues. I don't mean primarily the foreign relations issues or foreign policy issues, but then the divides and the voting of Czech Republic goes very much sometimes with according to some other lines than the old and new Europe. So again, I would rather look more carefully into what has been being shaped inside the EU and what are going to be the coalitions and shifting, dividing lines. And I think that there is a real possibility for Czechs and Poles and U.S. administrations to talk about what is in our mutual interest. If we are not going to be talking about what is in the mutual interest of both, then it's not going to work. I'm not very optimistic at the moment. I think it will take some time. I don't want to sound pessimistic, but I don't see any real realism into finding the real common issues and joint projects in the long term at the moment. I have some hints which were discussed among us, but I do not have any proof that it will materialize, that it is not just talking around the table, but that it will really materialize in joint projects, be it in the economic field, in energy field, be it in the military and security field, be it in the field of coordinating some policies in the areas of the importance for the West, for NATO, for transatlantic community. And we will see if that can be found, and if we in a few years could say that there have been such projects which have been really started, and that the decline of interest of U.S. in Central Europe does not continue. Because with that there is a decline of Czech Atlanticists seeing that sometimes it's too much waste of time to be knocking on the door here at Washington, and that we should be really primarily knocking other doors and somehow rethinking our strategies with respect to our security and democracy and prosperity. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Tomáš, on that non-optimistic but non-pessimistic note. And everybody's keeping to time, so we're going to have plenty of time for discussion. Next we have Heather. It's yours.
Thank you very much. I have to say, being the last member on this distinguished panel and coming before Dr. Brzezinski is quite a daunting task. I'm undeterred, but I'm daunted by it. It's a great pleasure to be with you. I see many faces, friends of Central Europe, both the former government officials and friends. It's a great pleasure to be with you today. I thought what I would do, and under Janusz's instruction, was try to play a little bit of cleanup, tie in some of the comments that you've already heard. But I wanted to put it in some personal perspective here as well. And as I was preparing to speak to you this morning, I struggled to find that moment in time when the strategic drift began, because it has been underway for some time. I think it's rapidly accelerated over the last 18 months. And what I came up with, I think I can pinpoint it to be about the beginning of 2004, where the U.S.-Central European relationship started drifting. And people may immediately think, ah, of course, that's when Poland and many of the Central Europeans became members of the EU, and it, of course, following Minister Sikorski's comments, that there's more Europe. But I don't want to suggest that that's why. I actually think that more Europe in Central Europe is a very good thing, and it's natural, and it's appropriate. I think the 2004, what I'd like to do, with your permission, is step back just for a few moments, and I'm going to do a great deal, not justice to a 20-year perspective of history, but I want to sort of go over what's happened over the last 20 years and talk about some what I believe to be some of the key ingredients of U.S. leadership in this region and creating the next project, if you will, for U.S. And Central Europe. So let's go back to 1989 very briefly. I believe that Washington works best under crisis and in a crisis mode. And I think from 1989 to 1991, you had obviously the dramatic changes in Polish leadership with Solidarity, German reunification, and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Washington was focused and concentrated on this region. Not only was it concentrated as far as its attention and its engagement, but it brought resources to bear. How many of you remember the SEED Act, that critical funding vehicle that provided the scholarships and the assistance to civil society and transformation? And again, what Minister Sikorski said about the Fulbright scholars, this was essential before the Cold War, but even more critical now. So there was leadership, there was motivation, and there were resources from the U.S. side. From 1992 to 1997, again, with U.S. leadership, within NATO, you started to see where the leadership was creative and energetic, creating partnership for peace. This was not a committee. This was not a council. This was a vehicle. This was getting reform processes on track. And I think, again, There were three critical elements that were occurring at this time, and I'm going to repeat them frequently as I talk. There was U.S. leadership and engagement and resources. That's number one. And number two, within Central Europe, there was a near political unity on the two goals of entering NATO and the European Union. Across the political spectrum, it rare was the case, and there were some cases, where that was not the goal. And so there was great political unity and purpose of entering NATO and the EU, supported by, again, U.S. And European leadership. And the third element, which we haven't touched on today, but I think was critical, was there was regional solidarity. When I began working at the State Department in September of 2001, one of the first processes I encountered was the Vilnius 10 process, where Central European countries were working together. They were pushing each other. When one stumbled, they were right there. They were focusing. They were saying, do the hard work. There was great regional solidarity. And I want to underscore that was a powerful element as well. So those were the three, I think, key elements in focusing U.S. leadership and engagement. I'm going to fast forward a little bit to the election of President Bush. And in the first 6 months, his journey to Warsaw, where he gave what I believe to be one of the most important foreign policy speeches of his tenure in Warsaw. And that, Kurt, to get back to your point, that was the vision thing. And it was leadership. It was good American leadership. Again, it was a bold statement. And many of the NATO allies were certainly not in this position in June of 2001. I'm going to quote from the speech. All of Europe's new democracies from the Baltic to the Black Sea and all that lie between should have the chance for security and freedom and the same chance to join the institution of Europe as Europe's old democracies have. That was a powerful vision. 3 months later, the world changed for the United States. And 4 months later, we began operations in Afghanistan. I think few at the time would believe that we are still in Afghanistan, and a strategic quandary right now on the way forward. So with America's focus in Afghanistan, and then 2 years later with its focus in Iraq, America's attention and focus would never fully return back to Europe writ large, unless it needed two things, validation and legitimization of its policies and contributions financially or militarily to its operations. So what happened in 2004, and I'm going to, for full disclosure, that was on my watch at the State Department as Deputy Assistant Secretary, so I bear some responsibility with that. Iraq took a huge political toll, clearly. And Central Europe, its great political courage, supported the United States. I don't believe they felt, and I'm happy for the panel to disagree with me completely, Central Europe did not feel that the United States appreciated that risk and that support at that time. So that took an enormous political toll. And the other toll that it took on the relationship was the visa waiver program. That was a cancer on the relationship, in my view. And the United States viewed the visa waiver program as a technical issue. This was a homeland security, count how many overstays. And Central Europe took it as a political issue. We are allies. We are fighting beside you. And for heaven's sakes, why can't we come into your country? And it took the United States a long time to figure this was an important issue, too long. And then we did not develop a quick way, an easy way, it was a very difficult way forward. And we did not preserve, and I think the Central European states did not preserve the regional solidarity and unity because they needed to work out the arrangement bilaterally with the United States. There was an EU role into that. And that weakened regional solidarity. So I want to underscore that those two issues, Iraq, visa waiver program, and the drift of Washington, again, being very focused on two major theaters of war, started to move away from one another. So now where do we move from the 2004 time frame? If President Bush's Warsaw speech in 2001 was the height, I think, for U.S. leadership in Europe over the past 8 years, its lowest point was the Bucharest summit in March of 2008, where that bold vision came to a grinding halt in a very open conversation that NATO wasn't too sure how it was going to proceed with enlargement. And that's where we sort of stopped a bit and searched for the path forward within NATO. You accelerate to August of 2008, where a significant event happens on the EU and NATO borders, and some members of both communities felt this was a significant event, others did not, and so without consensus of what that event meant for Europe's security, left some important questions. So now, and we're now November 2008, President Obama is elected, President-elect Obama, and the expectations, unrealistic perhaps, are abounding in Europe, the euphoria, the enthusiasm, and certainly equal enthusiasm here in the United States. And we're all in great anticipation. The president's many travels, his many visits to Europe very early in his tenure, I think underscored the promise of those expectations. But now we're at the point 9 months later of managing downward those unrealistic expectations. And I think part of that management came through in the missile defense rollout. I think we all agree that that was a failed rollout strategy and communication strategy. I think the lesson I learned from it is that missile defense was viewed as a domestic debate and conversation here, and there was a complete lack of understanding of the awareness in the context in which missile defense was discussed. And the minister's point about his pessimism, I do share some pessimism between the U.S. and Europe conversation. We talked past each other frequently. The United States talks about energy security, and most of our European colleagues talk about climate change. On missile defense, we're talking about Iran, and most of Europe is talking about the lack of confidence in Article 5, the future of an evolving Russia. We're talking past one another using a common language. We need to be very honest and have a frank dialogue and conversation. And our institutions, NATO and the U.S.-EU relationship, have to be supportive of that frank dialogue. But I want to conclude on a happy note. I think Minister Sikorski has given us the path forward on the next great U.S. Central Europe project. It's a U.S.-European project, and that is the Eastern Partnership. that policy, that's where the vision of a Europe whole, free, and at peace, the work is yet to be done. And my encouragement to the Obama administration, it's okay. The administration has differentiated itself from the Bush administration, but don't shy away from getting into the policy area in Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova. The vice president has shown great leadership here, but the rest of the administration and the State Department and AID, in collaboration with the European Union, need to follow through. And I think that's the most promising area where we can move away from strategic drift and get back on track. And the next great project after NATO and EU enlargement for this region is securing and building the reform agenda for those countries that seek a path forward in greater democratization and market reforms. So I'm going to end with a happy note. And Janusz, over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Heather. Our panelists were wonderful. I usually use yellow and red cards to give them warnings that they only have limited time, but didn't need to deploy them today. Let me take the opportunity of asking the first question while you formulate yours, and I'll pose it to Radek. The question I have is the impact of the Lisbon Treaty in terms of, for example, in terms of EU cohesiveness of EU foreign and security policy, not just towards Russia, that's one very important issue, but also towards the United States. Is it going to make any visible impact? Is it going to make European Union more of a partner for the United States? And if so, in which particular questions? And on the Russia side, of course, Russia policy is often tested during a crisis. I suppose the hypothetical question I have is, if the Russo-Georgian War and the partition of Georgia had happened during the course of the Lisbon Treaty, or when the Lisbon Treaty was already in place, would there have been any difference, do you think, in approach? Would the EU have handled it any differently? Would there be, in fact, Lisbon Treaty, does it mean more cohesion, or during a crisis potentially more conflict over foreign policy priorities?
Well, let me start with the last. Look, on Georgia, we acted very cohesively. I mean, it was, if I may say so, at my urging at the ministerial level, at the urging of our prime minister, at the heads of government level, but France, which held the presidency of the EU, sprang to action and did more than perhaps some of the people that the Georgians were counting upon. So it's not that Europe lacked unity. It's just that there is only so much that we as the West can do for a country that is not yet a member and is a logistical nightmare to assist. And on the Lisbon Treaty, it depends, because theoretically speaking, we will at least have a spokesman both at the head of government level and at the ministerial level. But I think the roles are so vaguely defined that everything depends on what caliber people we elect in the first round, because those people will set the precedence of what those jobs are. Are they just jobs to coordinate a little bit, or are they real powerful jobs of leaders who know their mind, have a vision, and are determined to bring Europe round and to deploy Europe's considerable resources to put those visions through? So that's why I think the next 2 weeks of consultations and who we come up with for those two jobs is absolutely crucial. The Lisbon Treaty, you may be interested to know, enables to do what the Bush administration was known for, well, for the concept the Bush administration launched, namely coalitions of the willing. Because, as you know, we have in Europe some countries that are neutral and even somewhat allergic to anything resembling hard security. But under Lisbon, we will be able to go forward in certain areas, and I can give you a preview. I expect the Polish-French summit tomorrow to unveil a major political initiative that will be to do with Poland's presidency of the EU in 2011. And Poland's major priority will be to put flesh on Europe's common foreign and security policy. So under Lisbon, Europeans will be able to go forward in integration in vital areas such as defense, which I think should be welcomed by the United States, because you have enough troubles around the world, and if Europe can at least take care of its own backyard in terms of security, and if we become a more valuable partner in leadership for you, then I think the cross that you're bearing will be lighter.
Tomasz?
Just two things. I 100% agree with that it's the effectiveness of the Lisbon Treaty will be shaped by the people whom we choose. I'm a little bit afraid that I would more bet on the lowest common denominator, which is going to win. But we will see. So that's going to be really setting up, because the real effects of the system functioning under the Lisbon Treaty will be seen not in months, but in few years. No one can now say and predict how exactly it will be done. Once we were preparing for our presidency, we were preparing that the Lisbon Treaty will take effect during our presidency. And there is so many unknowns and so many competing factors in how things should be done that then we will see, and we have to watch carefully very much the precedents which are going on. But what will be, I think, more important even than the foreign policy is exactly the issues of energy security, which are going to be discussed in the new set, and how much we will really use the Lisbon Treaty in dealing with the real issues of the energy security, and how much we will try to avoid the suicidal tendencies with respect to the climate change debate. And I think that that this series, I hope that we will be over that rather sooner than later. But there's the crucial issues which have to be discussed. And what is internally going to win and how that is going to be taken over by the new mechanisms and voting mechanisms within the EU, then it will have to some degree more and deeper effects than who is going to be the high representative for the foreign policy.
Okay, thank you, Tomasz. Three people, please signal to me sort of discreetly when you want to speak. I have three people. Stanley, first, if you could introduce yourself and your affiliation.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. Let me suggest that there's another more fundamental problem here. We're going through the traditional policy wonk approach, but the American people, I think, have lost interest in foreign affairs. That's the major concern. The Cold War ended. You know, people were confident. Fought the Iraq War, we won, went into the Balkans. But Iraq and Afghanistan, the initial euphoria after mission accomplished, and now you can just see it, disillusionment. That also goes for the NATO allies. The financial crisis has reinforced this. So I look around the country, people are concerned about unemployment, health insurance, education, infrastructure. The issues that animate us just don't seem to be that important. In the 1972 campaign, George McGovern said, "Come home, America," he lost. But my sense is the American people are saying, "Come home, America." It is resonating now. And the fiscal pressures will reinforce that. I mentioned the financial crisis. Some of us were at this meeting last night at the World Bank, and John Lipsky at the end said, the fiscal pressures are from promises that have been made. Not so much the fiscal stimulus to deal with the recession, the promises. And that suggests that other items in the budgets will have to be cut. I submit that defense is going to take a hit just because of the economic pressures. You know, as James Carville said, you want to be reincarnated as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody. And that is going to be the concern. And it will affect the Europeans probably even more than us, because their fiscal problems are at least as bad. So that's my concern, that the problems we are considering are a subset of something much, much larger.
Do you have a question, Stanley, or is that... That's just a comment. Okay. Okay. No, no, it's fine. Obrad?
Obrad Kesic, TSM Global Consultants. I was struck kind of by the tone of the comments of our colleagues from Europe, from the ministers. And I was struck by the tone of the comments from the ministers. And I'm wondering the efforts that the administration has invested in trying to give assurances to the region that the region's importance has not slipped in terms of U.S. policy, in terms of U.S. interests, seemed to be falling flat. And I'm wondering what is the reason that these assurances aren't convincing. Is it because of perhaps the change in U.S. policy towards Russia that seems to be creating a perception that these relations are improving in ways that could possibly threaten the interests of the region? Is it because of the strains that exist in the transatlantic relationship that are very apparent when it comes to Afghanistan and NATO, when it comes even to issues like Bosnia, following what's happening with the current negotiations and the lack of real consensus between the EU and the U.S. on those issues? Is it an issue that's affected? Are there issues that we don't really understand in terms of the economic crisis that puts the region somewhat at odds with the focus of this administration, or is it something else? What is the main reason that these assurances don't seem to be convincing to the region?
Anybody want to tackle this?
Why can't we be off the record?
Okay, close the tape.
Well, you can convince people by words, and we just had a very good trip by the vice president, and the words are convincing. But the point is that, you know, I'm a former defense minister, and what really convinces is the capabilities. And as I mentioned in my introduction, we've just had the largest Russian military exercise on the NATO border, on our border, in 20 years, using 900 tanks. NATO planners used to say that God created Poland for tank warfare. And so these tanks that we're exercising were 250 kilometers of flat ground from our capital city. We don't know what kind of message the Russian Federation was trying to send to us, but you can imagine what we heard. As Zbigniew Brzezinski said, and he wasn't the only one, what really reassured Germany, for example, during the Cold War, was not Article 5, which, as you know, is in fact quite vague, but the presence of 300,000 American troops in Germany. Now, we have, I think at the latest count, 6 American troops. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, outside the embassy.
They're very good, yeah.
If you had, on the one hand, 900 tanks, and on the other, 6 troops, would you be convinced?
How much?
Yeah, I think I can basically say the same. We have now, with the new administration, we have started talks about many issues not related only to missile defense and many other issues. Very concrete, very specific, what could be on the table. But we will be assured after really something materializes. And of course, I'm not expecting that everything is going to be done under the agreement of both sides. But at least something can be done for the mutual benefit, not for payoffs to the Czech Republic. But before I really see something, then, yes, we can. The promise is that there is going to be a good, new, strong instruments of the joint research development programs, also in the military field, but not only. That's fine. But I want to see that starting. On the other hand, I must say that I have seen something started, and something is moving on. So it's not that I would be completely pessimistic. I think that there can be something done. But we really want to see some results, and we really want to see over a year and 2 years that this has been done, here we have failed, here we have not agreed, and to make some kind of list, again, based on the mutual interests, not on some grants from the USI, because those grants are not going to take long. So it's just it's on the long-term projects. And there is potential, but so far we have not seen that much really happening.
If I can just chime in here, I think that the challenge here is, will the administration's policies be reactive or proactive? And thus far they have been reactive to concerns that have been heard from Central European leaders. And I think, you know, again, recognizing the July open letter from former Central European leaders to the Obama administration, and again, the difficulties with the missile defense rollout, those are reactive. The administration is reacting to concern, grappling with the transition that this relationship is experiencing. I would offer and suggest that the administration begin to formulate a proactive and positive agenda. Eastern Partnership and NATO and the NATO strategic concept is also part and parcel of that. Rather than reacting to where we don't like where we are, let's put together a positive plan and let's see where the administration can sustain engagement and leadership. And this is where I can't underscore enough resources, and this perhaps gets back to the fiscal deficit and the challenges. When Minister Sikorsky was in the Ministry of Defense, it was very difficult for the U.S. administration to cobble together sufficient funding to support Poland's modernization efforts, and that struggle continues today. It is a critical issue, and resources have got to be part of the plan. Because the words sound wonderful, but unless we put resources and manpower to the development of this relationship, particularly in the security side of it, it's just going to be talk. And again, I would submit that while the popularity of the president, President Obama, is fantastic, and it gives space for the creation of this plan, it can't be the only thing. A policy must be developed for this region, and that's what I think we're all anxious to see be formulated.
So do we need a reset button for Central Europe? That's it. Mike, please.
Now, I'm Mike Haltzell, Johns Hopkins SAIS, and McLarty Associates. I agree with Radha completely that we need to have more of a presence in Central and Eastern Europe, especially in the north. I think after Zapadjevit, we certainly should get our major West European allies to agree to contingency planning and the maneuvers and the stationing of some troops. I would say, just as a historical footnote, the United States, England and France never had more than 12,000 troops plus a few military bands in West Berlin for 40 years. They were surrounded by the East German Volksarmee and 400,000 Red Army troops. So it's a question of trust, too. I mean, we're never going to get enough troops in Northern Europe in order to offset a potential tank invasion, but it's a question of trust. Let me just say, I think Roddick was very diplomatic about saying that Russia can go either way. The jury is still out. Count me on the pessimistic side. I think that the overwhelming evidence is negative right now, and I think there's time pressure for us to do something. Putin's statement just a few days ago to Ukraine about a new gas crisis coming up in the winter. The Medvedev letter to Yushchenko in the summer sounded to me a lot like 1938, Germany to Czechoslovakia. The Russians are buying up strategic assets all over Europe and political ones. And when I was in Warsaw last month at the OSCE Human Rights Conference, we talked to dissidents from Russia who were forced to leave the country and who are now being harassed by FSB agents in countries in Central and Eastern Europe that are members of NATO and the EU. It's a really serious thing. And finally, I know Radek was at the Corfu ministerial at the end of June, which is now evolved into something called the Corfu process, how to respond to Medvedev's call for a new European security architecture. However boring it may have been, however many platitudes were said, the fact is there is a process in train, and I think that the United States and its European allies and also non-NATO European friendly countries really have to get their act together to respond to this. The language hasn't been fleshed out yet. What we've seen so far is more or less a rehash of 1950s Soviet language, but it's serious and it's happening. So we have to react. One final optimistic word. I'm eager to hear what Carl Bildt has to say later today, but it strikes me that one area where the United States and Europe, or at least EU-Europe, is cooperating is on Bosnia-Herzegovina. Steinberg-Bildt initiative, which followed on Vice President Biden's taking Solana with him to the Balkans in May, I think is very hopeful. All three communities in Bosnia have come out against the plan, which maybe says something for it. But the fact is we are cooperating, and I think that's something that we should look at. That's one of the areas in Europe that certainly is not stable. It may be free nominally, but it's certainly not stable, and I think that's something we ought to recognize as some kind of progress.
Thanks, Mike. I'd also like to hear what Carl Bildt would have to say. Unfortunately, he's not joining us today. He pulled out a couple of days ago. He's obviously busy with Bosnia, amongst other things. We have, I think, about five people along this side. Maybe start with, yeah.
Thank you. Vesta Pavilonis from Lithuania, chairing now Community of Democracy presidency. Well, I would very much agree with different speakers that, first of all, we have to be creative. We had different projects. NATO enlargement, Vilnius 10 was mentioned, EPIN, Nordic-Baltic cooperation, to keep Americans present. But now, you know, the world is developing and we're not reacting with new creative ideas. I would very much agree with very two natural things that were mentioned. Eastern policies, of course, this is our natural hemisphere where without us you will simply not fix this territory. I would also agree very much with security gap in Central Europe. That's growing, that's important, and we have to do something. But I would also think a bit more globally. Minister Sikorski mentioned, look, we could be useful with our recent experience in transforming ourselves in different parts of the world. We are simply very similar people for different regions, for different reasons, cultural, economic, freedom, fighting nations always, you know, facing difficulties around. We are together in Afghanistan in most difficult places, from southern regions to different provinces. We've been together in Iraq. We could be helpful in places like Honduras. We could do a lot in places like Burma or some other places. So we need to have those instruments like Community of Democracies mentioned, but, you know, investing into them and using potential of those similarities that we have globally. And then, you know, we could be quite a good partners. And maybe last thing, well, on our dear old Europe, we know this Europe quite well already after all those accessions and transformations and instruments. For example, my president is, you know, former commissioner. She could be also helpful in you know, speaking with Europeans sometimes, and with people like Minister Sikorski and others, you know, we could be useful in opening the doors in Brussels also.
Thank you. Does anybody want to jump in from the panelists? Otherwise, I'll go. Radek, go ahead.
I don't have anything to add to what Ambassador Pavilionis said, but I feel that we failed to answer the gentleman from Cato. And I think he may have a valid point that... look, you know better than I what the American people want or can afford. But if the imperial overstretch has finally come, then we would like to know that. You know, if you're saying that the US can no longer afford to be the superpower that guarantees public goods to certain countries, like security, then I think it would be useful to be told this honestly. Because the last thing we would like is to have a guarantee that doesn't work. when push comes to shove. Yeah. The implicit deal between us is you give us security, we give you deference. If you can't afford it, please tell us.
Kurt? Yeah.
Thanks, because I was going to come back toward the end to make some of this, but I think Minister Sikorski has just said, then maybe it's worth jumping in now. But I think there are a couple of things to bring up at this stage. One of them is we can't look at each other instrumentally. So the U.S. just can't look at Europe, as Heather was saying, and say, okay, give us the troops or give us the money. Likewise, Europe can't look at the United States instrumentally and say, okay, you're the fire company, we'll call you when we need you, but we want you ready. And otherwise, you know, we'll go do our thing. That's not a community. And in particular, I think that when we've talked about some of the interests here, it has quickly been the conversation moved to what's the Central European interest, what's the American interest, how do we align them. I really do think we have to look at shared interests based on some broader sets of issues, based on democratic values, based on the kind of Euro-Atlantic community we want to live in, and based on the virulent threats that exist outside of that Euro-Atlantic community that we have to deal with. We have to see ourselves as a community of values where the values matter and where we will only tackle these external challenges well if we are doing it together. The second thing is to reiterate a point that was made, but by seeing ourselves as a community, we also emphasize a positive view of where we're trying to go. It's one of the things that always drove me crazy when I was at NATO was people making the argument that, well, if we don't do something, NATO's not relevant. Well, who cares if NATO's relevant? That's not the point. The point is, are you helping people live in democratic societies? Are you helping them guarantee their livelihoods for the future so they can live in greater prosperity? Can they be secure? Will there be greater stability? Those are the things we're trying to do. NATO is an instrument for doing that, as are many other things, instruments for doing that. So we have to get focused back on that positive vision. And to take a slightly different view on a couple of things, one of them, I won't dwell on it, but I would have some very different things to say about Georgia if that comes back up in the conversation from what had already come up. But on the point about the United States and imperial reach or fatigue of the American public, I mean, we go through this all the time. This is not a particularly new thing. The U.S. can't escape the fact that we live in a world where we are everyone else's primary interest, whether positive or negative, whether it is publics that aspire to live in a society of greater democratic values, or whether it's terrorists that want to attack the United States, or whether it's countries that want that insurance policy. So it is a fact that we have to deal with. And we're a big enough country and a capable enough country that we can deal with that. There are limits imposed by our political process, and by the way, those in government react to that political process. But I wouldn't count the U.S. out of foreign policy. We just can't escape it.
Okay, thanks, Kurt. Please.
Alon Redlich, business advisor. One of the legs of the stool in this relationship is the business element and the investment element. And I believe that it would be very valuable even for non-business people to think through how do we increase that element. I could speak about Poland, which is the territory I work in. I think it's one of the best-kept secrets in terms of the opportunity. We have been part in the last 5-6 years in acquisitions that provide thousands and thousands of jobs in Poland. Tremendous opportunities are coming out of Poland, and yet if you would have 100 of the Fortune 100 CEOs sitting in this panel right now, they would say, why Poland? So I believe that one of the key elements that we have to continue pushing and do better at is to establish American interests, for example, in Poland or in the Czech Republic from an investment perspective. Speaking for the people I work with, they could go around the world investing anywhere. and we come back to Poland again and again and again. Today we have 8,000 employees in Poland because of a good educational system, because of the work ethics, because of the government keeping far away enough to let us do our job. And yet when we compete with companies, when we compete to privatize companies or to buy companies, our competition is only European. We don't have three other American companies competing for these opportunities. And the message to me is that Poland is not on the agenda of enough American CEOs and enough American presidents of companies. So this is really a challenge to the American party and to the Polish party. How do we raise this? How do we make this an opportunity? And how do we make this a little bit more known fact? I think there's an interesting model to follow in Israel in terms of Israel has once a year a prime minister conference that's held in Jerusalem where the prime minister invites targeted heads of companies and over 3 days presents opportunities. It's done in other countries as well. I have not yet seen that done at such a level in Poland. And I encourage both the American side and the Polish side to highlight the successes. There's a long list of successes that most people don't know about. Thank you.
I'm so glad Sikorski is doing well in Poland.
Thank you, sir.
He's not doing so bad here either. So, please, who is next along? Yes, mister.
Andrzej Olechowski from Poland. While it is very important, of course, to decide if the U.S. Central European relations are in adrift or in a strategic mode, it is much more important to know that about the U.S. European relations at large, because if the big ship is on a solid course, local problems on deck number two or number three are important, but not critical, of course. And basically, what I wanted to do is to ask the question to the U.S. Panelists about what do they think about the state of U.S.-Europe relations. Is that relationship, which historically was so successful, so important for both our continents, is it still very much on your mind, or is it the box that has been checked prematurely, I would say, since I believe that it continues to be the relationship in the world. We're still the only parties that can destroy stability of the world in a way that nobody else would be able to mend it. So we should stick together for a number of reasons, but one of them being that capacity, that unique capacity that we have. If we were to stick together, and if we were to believe that this is a strategically most important relationship, then the Atlantic community, we should also realize that the Atlantic community is an unfinished business. And therefore efforts should be made to complete it in the ways that were indicated by Minister Sikorski, to enlarge it by including six Eastern partners, and then of course do outmost to include Russia in that community as well. You would say yes, it is European business first and foremost, but we know very well that Europe continues to be occupied with domestic problems, with internal problems, and will continue to be so for some years to come. Now we are hoping very much that with the signing in of Lisbon Treaty, we'll be on a much better way. But it will take us some time. It's the nature of the beast. It's not gonna go away very quickly. So if we were to care about the further development of Atlantic Community, U.S. would need to exercise its leadership and strategic role for a few years to come, as it did in the past. And I stop here and ask for your comments.
Okay, thanks very much. Heather?
Thank you very much. Sort of break it into two parts. What Central Europe, I think, felt first and earliest, sort of this disquiet about the state of U.S.-European relations is felt throughout Europe. And again, it's we're just in this challenging moment. I'm not sure I'm going to articulate it sufficiently. It sort of comes the conclusion of the Bush administration, the euphoria with President Obama, that all the problems that were sitting on the agenda, that were weighing down the U.S.-European relationship, would disappear quickly, and we'd be entering a new era. And again, unrealistically, I think those thoughts were held. And we're dealing with a period now that, you know, the current administration is slogging through some really difficult tasks. It's difficult to close Guantanamo. It is difficult to find the right way forward in Afghanistan. It is difficult to address issues of Middle East peace process in Iran, all while, as Europe is very domestically focused, we're very domestically focused as well with the global economic crisis, healthcare, energy, the list goes on and on, 10% unemployment, the list goes on and on and on. So at a time where both the U.S. And Europeans are very inwardly focused, a lot of energy directed towards that. We're at this moment of disquiet because where everything should be going so well, that's what we anticipated, things aren't going well. Climate change, Copenhagen was supposed to be a success, and now we're trying to manage through some potential disappointment. The U.S.-European relationship will be, I think, for the next 20 years or so, it will be a valued relationship. For my earlier points, because I think it's absolutely essential. American foreign policy requires the validation and the legitimization that Europe provides to our policy directions. We need to consult first. Obviously, I think gone are the days where unilateral approaches will occur again. The American people want solidarity with other countries as we move forward. But I'm concerned about where we are heading. And I'm concerned that the 2-5% of where U.S. and Europe disagree becomes the predominant discussion, and the 95% of where I think we do agree isn't focused on. So we need to develop that dialogue, and it's not to create another council, another committee. While we appreciate that our European colleagues, the process and the institutional structures are very important. Americans sometimes find that frustrating, and it can't be a substitute. The process can't be a substitute for the ultimate action that takes place. And so we've always wrestled with that, and I think we will continue to do that. Historically, we're at a point where the post-World War II structures, be that Bretton Woods, and in some respects NATO, and even now the EC, the European Union, they were designed for a period of time, and they're coming against some challenging moments geopolitically and certainly economically. So you have the G7, which is turning into the G20, and the Americans now have to speak with Beijing directly on some important economic issues and then discuss that challenge with Europe. It's no longer U.S. talking directly with the Europeans and then the rest of the world sort of following that suit. We're trying to learn and change the new dynamics. It's uncomfortable for everyone because we're in this new place. The architecture that was created out of the Second World War is groaning under the weight of a success under enlargement. How are we more effective at the table of 28 at NATO? How is the EU more effective via the Lisbon Treaty, to 27. These are the important challenges. So we're just at this, we're at this awkward moment. It doesn't feel good. We know we're not in a good place, but we're not sure how to move forward. I'll come back to the NATO strategic concept process, and Minister Rotfeld is engaged in that with the experts group. NATO has to have the courage to ask itself some very tough questions. If it doesn't, then this process has been a moot point. If it asks itself some tough questions and starts designing itself to be more effective and more relevant to the challenges of the 21st century, then I think we'll see a more reinvigorated U.S.-European, again, the cornerstone is NATO, that transatlantic dialogue. If that starts drifting, I think the path of the relationship over slowly over time will be diminished.
Okay, thank you, Heather. Kurt?
Thank you. And I want to first off agree with the minister. I think in my opening comments I said drift within Central and Eastern Europe is a symptom, not a cause, and it's a symptom of a broader transatlantic drift. And I do think that U.S.-European relations are not in a good shape right now. There are a lot of people who would comment on the U.S. side of that equation and the administration. I won't do that. I'll comment on the European side instead and just say that it's clear that with or without the Lisbon Treaty, and now with, there is a lack of unity within Europe, lack of fundamental agreement on some of the big issues. There has been a lack of investment in capacities for how to act internationally in foreign policy. In many cases, a lack of a global view. There are a few countries that have one. I think Poland is one that does, but many countries don't. There is a lack of a sense of how to deal with the United States or even others in the world, but how to deal with the U.S. Yesterday, we had here a U.S.-EU summit where the EU was represented by Prime Minister Reinfeldt, Javier Solana, and President Barroso. Well, I think a honest observer would say, with all due respect to the individuals who are perfectly fine people, but people say, that's Europe? That's our dialogue with Europe is with those three? The same day, we have Chancellor Merkel in town, who's having her own separate meeting with the president and her own separate things on the Hill. That tells you something, I think, about Europe being united and Europe figuring out how to deal with the United States. I think that Europe still, as you said, tends to be inward-looking and institution-building, perfectly understandable, but it is a limitation if that's the core focus. I do agree with Thomas when he said that the likely outcome seems to be the lowest common denominator on leadership, because that will preserve the interests of the large countries the best. And I think that's what they're interested in doing right now, is protecting the large country freedom of maneuver. And from a foreign policy perspective, I think that we have a vastly different sense of urgency in the United States compared to Europe in dealing with the issues that we've got, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or terrorism or proliferation. We feel a sense of immediacy, and we don't always feel that from our European partners. So I do think that things are in a difficult position right now. And to repeat myself, I think it comes back to really thinking hard about what our shared interests are as a community rather than the short-term, lower-level interests that we can all identify that might pull us in different directions.
Okay, thanks, Kurt. There was a lady, I think, on the... there was one other person here, please.
Andrew Pierre, Georgetown University. I'd like to offer a slightly contrarian view on the subject of East and Central European disquiet, malaise, and so on, although my thinking flows very much along the lines of Ms. Connolly and Mr. Volker in some ways. I've just come back from 4 weeks in Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan on a trip sponsored by the State Department to talk about Obama's foreign policy, the changes the last 9 months or so. So given where our priorities are, I focus on Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, the broad nuclear issue, not just missile defense, but of course missile defense. And except for the specific issue of missile defense, I found, and let me say also that my audiences were not ministries of foreign affairs or ministers of foreign affairs. They were university groups, think tanks to some extent, diplomatic training academies, and certainly the media. So I was very interested in seeing what kind of a response I would get to the issues I was discussing. And the answer was a generally uninformed and uninterested response. Afghanistan, primary in our scope at this point, is really not at all in terms of response that I got from particularly the media and the student groups. Now, this is understandable in many ways, but I raise the question as to whether the news is not good rather than bad. You know, we're all professionals, so we tend to take a sort of a sober and somewhat negative view about the state of our world. But as I look upon Central and Eastern Europe, we've had decades of serious issues which we had to deal with. The Cold War in all its manifestations. And after the Cold War, the whole process of enlargement, NATO, EU, and the set of new relationships. True, that is ground somewhat to halt at this point. But if the United States is not focusing on Central and Eastern Europe, and I accept that it is not, isn't that in some ways a sign of success of the last decades? And the fact that we are focusing on more urgent problems as we see them should make our Central and East European friends somewhat pleased in the sense that they are not the problem. They have the opportunity to assist the United States in dealing with other parts of the world. And they are, in a professional way that ministers of defense and foreign affairs know about, but the public doesn't know a great deal about. And to the extent that it does, it's somewhat reluctant to see that assist. So I don't think the sense of malaise is necessarily that bad. And I also find it very hard to get beyond the realm of sort of general rhetoric to specifics. I read four times the letter from the Central East European leaders of last August, I think it was, July and August. I kept reading it to see what it was specifically that they were asking the United States to do. The list that I came up with was a very short list. So international affairs and foreign policy is full of malaise always. That's why we have conferences. But in terms of what we want to do about it, it's not that clear. There have been a number of suggestions here, but they frankly pale in significance in terms of what our leaders have to think about on very serious issues. I wish I could have seen a greater connect in the thinking of the people with whom I was speaking, but between, let's say, for example, Afghanistan, terrorism, security, including terrorism in all of Europe, that's a good case, but there are others. Iran could be cited as such. So as a contrarian at this point, let me just say we should celebrate rather than be unhappy about whatever we call the sense of malaise or disquiet. Welcome any comments.
Okay, thanks, Brent. Does anybody want to jump in, or should we take a few more? Take a few more. Mr. Kulesh, I think there's one. I think you're the last one on this table. And then there's, I don't want to leave anybody out. There was a lady on my extreme right and a gentleman on my extreme left. So to radicalize the conversation, I think we'll include those in a moment.
Okay, Łukasz Kulesa, Polish Institute of International Affairs. And my comments are directly related to the previous speaker's points about Afghanistan. When I when I look at the future, whether the strategic drift is going to accelerate or whether we can see some convergent interests, then I'm not quite optimistic when I look at the Afghan discourse. There is an original sin, as in my reading, when we look at the engagement of the countries of Central Europe in Afghanistan. The original sin is that it was considered by a large part of the populations as another way to strengthen the relationship with the United States, and also as a way to show the unity in NATO, which was fine until it turned out that it's really much more complicated and much more difficult business than we first thought. And now we're at the level that I think 86 to 87% of Poles are opposed to the mission, and the figures are not much better in most other countries of Central Europe. NATO solidarity, we all see how it looks with countries accusing one another of not doing enough or using the wrong tactics in a particular part of the region. And in the United States itself, where we also hear contradicting messages with some saying, some giving us a new version of the domino theory, saying that if Afghanistan goes, then goes Pakistan, and there goes everybody else. So putting the effort in Afghanistan as the most pressing challenge of the modern times, whereas other saying that actually we can scale down our activities. We can concentrate on special operations. We can move to other missions. So this is not a coherent message. And now the need for the U.S. leadership was mentioned several times here. I think when you look at the Afghan operation, this is a U.S.-run operation with more or less the engagement of other partners. So this is one of the areas when the U.S. leadership is quite evident, and the need to have clear answers of what we are doing there, how long does it take, and what's the end state, is getting more and more urgent. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Maybe we will take the extreme left and extreme right, please.
Thanks. Speaking from the left here, I'm Mitchell Orenstein from the European Studies Department at Johns Hopkins SAIS. I have a question for Minister Sikorski, if I may. One of the really damaging crisis that could be caused by Russia, if they should so choose to do so, and as you know, in this town, there are people who believe that take a more benign view of Russia and those that take a more pessimistic view. But taking the pessimistic view for a moment, the damaging crisis could occur if Russia were to intervene in more dramatic ways in Ukraine. And I wonder, in your opinion, it appears from our point of view or from my point of view, that the European Union itself really doesn't have too much of a policy on Ukraine or on preventing such an event from happening, despite, of course, the very warranted and good efforts of the Republic of Poland to draw the European Union closer into that. So I ask you, first of all, is there an EU policy? What's Poland's relation to that EU policy? And what would a joint U.S.-EU policy, in fact, be to prevent something that the pessimists fear occurring?
Radek, do you want to tackle this?
Sure, and I'd like to agree with you that we all wish that for a constructive Russian approach and for Russia to take a benign trajectory. But I take your assumption that there is a another possibility. Well, Europe is negotiating with Ukraine an association agreement. I personally traveled to Kiev last summer at the behest of the presidency of the EU with my German colleague, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and we handed to the president, the prime minister, the chairman of parliament, the foreign minister of Ukraine a paper which was a list of conditions that if Ukraine fulfills, then she would get an association agreement, which is to say a deep free trade zone this year. But as you know, the Ukrainian parliament is not exactly a font of legislation this year. with an association agreement and with energetic Ukrainian commitment to becoming a member, such as all of our countries had to show for years before we made the grade, I could imagine Ukraine joining the European Union sometime after 2020. The Treaty of Rome says any European country that fulfills the criteria may join. There is retirement fatigue, it's true. Enlargement fatigue. But if Ukraine fulfilled the criteria, took full advantage of Eastern Partnership, then I think in some years' time she could make a really good case. And that would change its internal politics too, because the majority of the Ukrainian people would, including the business community, joining Europe is a very attractive and beneficial thing for your country, and that could diffuse the kinds of problems that you mentioned. So that's Europe's policy, but Ukraine has to do what she has to do. And our policy is to do something for Ukraine each time Ukraine does something for herself.
Tomáš, you want to say a few words?
Yeah, just on the letter which was published, we handed over to the U.S. administration two very specific, we think very realistic lists of what can be done. Not as a shopping list what should be paid by U.S., but a specific list, and not only in the military field, of joint projects. We will see what will be realized out of it. And this is nothing new. It has been worked out in the last years, so there is a continuity of that, and I think it's very much known here what we are talking about in this specific. So that's how we will be judging of how worth it is to concentrate on it. I hope that it's going to be successful, at least in some spheres. But again, it's hard to say now. On Afghanistan, Czech Republic is a 10 million country in Central Europe. So I think we should not be expected that we will be taking care of every issue around the world in the distant countries. We've been modestly concentrating on the neighborhood, on the Balkans, Eastern Europe, and there we think it's in our direct interest we can continue. With Afghanistan, yes, we have contributed per capita in terms of forces the same as the U.S., fighting in the south without caveats. But it is not directly primarily our war. We do not get in Czech Republic as a homogeneous society without the immigrant suburbs. We do not see the direct threat there. So we have willingly joined the coalition. But to be asking Czech public to be supporting enthusiastically engagement in Afghanistan, when we do see the public figures here also in the U.S., again, it's going to be now even harder to get the Czech parliamentarians to support the Afghanistan, because those Atlantists always supporting the Afghanistan engagement of Czech Republic. They have been weakened and they have been fed up, some of them, in the parliament. And I did speak with many parliamentarians on that issue. So I'm not saying that the Czech Republic will be pulling out. No, we will not be pulling out. But we should not be asked to be showing that much enthusiasm that it is the war which will be on the front pages of the discussion in Czech Republic. It will be in the front pages only when our forces are killed, so I hope it's not going to be the real discussion in Czech Republic about that, so it's going to go rather smoothly.
Thank you, Tomáš. There were three other people. Lady at the back, if you could stand up, there should be a microphone. Zorica, Keith, suddenly a lot of hands shoot up. Okay, we'll take as many as possible. Please, start over here.
I'm Sally McNamara from the Heritage Foundation, so how apt that I'm on your right here. My question is about the Lisbon Treaty. We've heard some rather muted excitement that this is going to increase the EU's ability to act, this is going to increase the EU's capacity to improve democracy in Eurasia and all these places. I wonder if the panel's not remotely concerned with the fact that the Lisbon Treaty was introduced without any sort of democratic legitimacy or credibility whatsoever. We have to remember that three countries in Europe actually rejected this treaty, and the Irish Commissioner, Charlie McCreevy, said about 95% of countries would have rejected it if they were given the chance to say so. I think that this is a bit of an overestimation. I think only 18 out of the 27 wouldn't have wanted it. However, under the EU's own rules, only one has to reject it in order for it to go away. I ask you this question not as one of morality. I stopped talking about morality in the EU in the same sentence a long time ago. I ask you as a question of practicality. The Lisbon Treaty gives the Americans the message: we can take on more of our own security, we are going to increase our capacity to act. Any administration, Republican or Democrat, is going to be very, very excited by this. However, what if Russia does take its chances with another country other than Georgia? The US administration could quite legitimately turn around and say, well, hold on, you have the Lisbon Treaty, you said that this was going to increase your capacity for action. None of our business, Governor. We need to send the message that U.S. leadership in Europe still matters, and the Lisbon Treaty does the exact opposite.
Radek is dying to take this question.
Well, look, each member country has its own constitutional process in approving the Lisbon Treaty. It's different in every country. The Irish had a referendum and they said yes. We did it through Parliament and by the agreement of our president. But one of the countries which unequivocally Her Majesty the Queen gave her royal assent, and Britain, one of the earlier countries that ratified the Lisbon Treaty, and I hope you're not going to say that it's undemocratic. I don't think the Lisbon Treaty has any bearing on Georgia. Georgia is not formally an ally, either in NATO or in the framework of the EU. And look, nothing was preventing the United States to come to Georgia's assistance last year, and nothing will prevent the United States from coming to Georgia's assistance in the future, Lisbon or no Lisbon. But I think as the largest economy on earth, Europe, we will have occasions on which we need to back up our interests, economic and otherwise, with force, because that's the only way to do effective diplomacy sometimes. And it's high time that we should do that, because there are plenty of examples of countries that are rich and weak, and usually something bad happens to them.
Okay, Tomáš, you want to say? Zorica and then Keith, and I think there are a few people here. Start with Zorica.
Thank you, Janos. Zorica Maj, Defense Counselor at the Embassy of Montenegro. Coming from the Western Balkans, I don't need to convince you how much we worry when we hear there is a drift in a U.S.-European relationship. And when there is a strategic drift, we even worry much more. However, we are rather encouraged with the renewed commitment of the U.S. Administration for the Balkans, and because we are at the point where we need U.S. and European relationship to work in a way that would help Western Balkans to really give us the final push towards European Union and a NATO membership. I would like to ask you, how do you see the impact of this drift on the Western Balkans and unfinished business on the Western Balkans? Because it really is important both from the policy and security side of the topic. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad you raised that, Kurt.
Sure. I'll just address that briefly. Happened to be in Montenegro about 10 days ago, and I think it's critically important. As I talked about in my presentation, I think that getting ourselves back on track with the vision of a Europe whole, free, and at peace is critically important for the people that we're talking about, whether it's the Balkans or Ukraine or Georgia or Moldova or Belarus. So that's first. Secondly, it's critically important for the kind of neighborhood that we all live in, so for the EU, for NATO, for the United States. And it's also critically important for the signal that it sends to Russia, because it gets the values and the performance basis of democratic societies back up on the agenda as a means by which we then tailor our engagement with Russia. We want to reach out to Russia and work together, but it's got to be based on some principles. And I think getting that vision right is critically important to doing that. I do think that there is the beginnings of some renewed momentum and interest in the Balkans. It's not gone very far yet. It's good to have a country like Montenegro as a country that has made a certain number of steps on reforms and is willing to push us to say, you got to pay attention. But we have real problems in Bosnia. We have an EU divided over Kosovo. We need desperately to find the right way of bringing Serbia closer to the European mainstream. I certainly hope that with the new Greek government and some new efforts on the part of the Macedonian government, we could see some movement on the name issue and movement on Macedonia joining Western institutions. So there is something to work with there, but there's a lot yet to do on the Balkans, and I do think it needs to be a priority. In fact, a near-term priority, because I should take this point out. I agree with everything that Radek said about Ukraine. I think that the Eastern Partnership is an excellent tool. I think a lot of the responsibility rests in the Ukrainians themselves, and I hope that on our side of the Atlantic we can match that.
Okay. Thanks, Kurt. Keith next. I'm sure you're going to raise the energy question, and then we'll run through whoever else wants to make a comment or ask a question. Then we'll go finish off with the panelists, because I want to have a 5-10 minutes break before Dr. Brzezinski speaks.
I'm not quite that unidimensional, but Janek,
I said you looked energized.
Yeah,
sorry.
But in any case, a couple things occur to me. And, having been in Europe at the time that there was the big bang, the 8 countries were going to join the EU, join NATO. And then there was all this talk about coming into the EU was going to bring us soft security. In fact, I was in Warsaw the day that Poland became a member of the EU. And I went around asking people, how do you feel about this? And there was, people didn't know how to feel about it at that time, and I can understand that. It was new. But it's the question of, I look at the, ministers, of course, you mentioned the military exercise the Russians just conducted. What was the reaction of the EU to that military exercise? This is, what kind of a soft security indication did you get from that? I look back at Lithuania. Pardon?
You said the same as nature.
Yeah, well, that's right. But I look back at Lithuania when Lithuania was cut off from the oil from the Druzhba pipeline. What was the reaction of the EU? Nothing. What was the reaction when the Poles tried to raise energy security as an issue to be discussed at NATO? There were several big NATO countries that said, no, this doesn't belong on the agenda. I myself tried to discuss energy security at the Economic Committee of NATO and was told, no, there's a couple of big members who don't want this to be on the agenda. And I think, well, the United States has been back and forth. We've been engaged in, and not only in Afghanistan and Iraq, but a lot of other things that are going on, our relations with China taking a large chunk of our time. But my question really for the minister or for the Europeans on the panel is, what are the Europeans, is there some kind of a coalition of the willing within the Central European group? Are the Central Europeans themselves trying to form a coalition which in fact can invigorate both the EU Commission to look out for the interests of these countries, the security and both economic and military security, and in NATO? Is there a kind of group? Because there are probably 4 big members, 5 big members of the EU that have really very little interest in doing anything which might be seen as confrontational with Russia, even if it affects the energy security or the military security of our Central European friends. Is there something going on behind the scenes in which people are beginning to try to form a coalition which can do something?
Okay, thanks, Keith. Let me gather the other questions, then you can respond. Minister Rotfeld, I think you had something.
Thank you very much. In fact, my intention is to say that for obvious reason, we are very much oriented to the relations between the states, between the United States and Europe, between the United States and in some specific countries in Central Eastern Europe. But the main problems at the moment, it seems to me, are emerging within the states. And neither the European Union, but first of all NATO and many other multinational institutions are not really designed to deal with the internal domestic issues. I would like not to be to violate the rules of political correctness, but it seems to me that it is a time to discuss in very serious way the problem of parochialism in many countries who are much more oriented to the very marginal problems of domestic nature because they have the feeling that they are secure from outside. In other words, there is no direct threat to their security, and as a result, they are discussing a lot of issues which are really sometimes seeing from outside very, I would like to say, marginal, not to say infantile, but it is the problem which should be raised, in other words, not only to criticize somebody who should take responsibility, but to take responsibility for themselves. And here my comment in the context of the letter addressed to the Obama's administration from Central Eastern European former politicians or intellectuals, researchers. I would like to say that the letter was motivated mainly by the fact that in the United States, that region was seen as a kind of the success story, and it was put into the box, mission accomplished. And I mentioned this problem of internal nature, domestic problems, to say that at the moment they are not emerging, the internal domestic issues are not in fact provoking a kind of the serious conflict. But if it is not taken seriously, it could be something what happened, for example, between Hungary and Slovakia, what might happen among some other countries, should not be ignored, because it seems to me that it is a new agenda, and this agenda is not really defined properly. In other words, it is not my question, it is rather a comment to some observations which were made today. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much. I think that will be it with comments from the floor. Please save any questions and other ideas you have for this afternoon. We'll continue this conversation. Let's now turn to the four panelists, maybe the order in which they started. Kurt, for your concluding comments.
I guess I think we've exhausted a lot of the topics that have come up already. I'm not going to dwell on those. So I think what I'll do, if given the opportunity to take the floor one more time, is just say a couple words about Georgia. I think Minister Sikorski made the point that the EU acted very quickly, and we're all glad that the EU did, and it was a coordinated effort, I'd say, with the United States. We wanted the EU to take the lead in order to defuse the immediate conflict, to create a ceasefire, stop forces from moving towards Tbilisi. At the time, Secretary of State was Condoleezza Rice. She met with Sarkozy in south of France, maybe in Toulon, and then went to Georgia to meet with Saakashvili and urge him to agree to the same ceasefire agreement that the French had pushed in Moscow. All of that very good, and a good use of EU diplomacy. So I agree to that point. But then I want to mention a few other things that I think we can't forget, that the ceasefire was never fully implemented, so the agreements that were reached were not carried through. There is not an access of monitors from the European Union or from the OSCE to the territories of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Russia recognized these territories as independent states. They increased the size of their military presence there on the basis of having been invited. This follows on having issued passports to people in those regions and then saying they're protecting Russian citizens. So what we've seen is a fairly direct change of borders in Europe through military force. And a tendency in the part of Europe to blame Georgia for that, saying, well, you shouldn't have provoked the Russians. Well, yes, there were Georgian mistakes, but mistakes carried out in the context of a couple-year period of significant Russian pressure on Georgia, which resulted in this change of borders by force. So when we talk about these issues of soft security, hard security, what's happening in Europe, I just think we have to have this in the back of their mind, in the back of our minds, that things may not be as settled as we have gotten used to them being. And we should be very pragmatic, careful, and plan ahead about what are the potential future risks that are out there as we see this more authoritarian Russia that we're dealing with and the pressure that it applies and has applied on its neighbors.
Okay, thanks, Kurt. Radek, concluding comments?
Well, I just wanted to explain myself why I didn't mention the issue of visas.
Gave you a perfect opportunity.
I didn't mention because we are so annoyed by it that we've stopped asking. And you know, ask yourself why there is a catastrophic collapse in the popularity of the United States in the region, according to the latest Pew poll. Well, we put 18,000 troops through Iraq, 2,000 more in Afghanistan. Most of those guys could not get into the U.S. Is that wise? I don't know. Hungary and Slovakia. I'm a great admirer of Minister Rotfeld. So it's and it's nationalism in Eastern Europe is a wonderful stereotype, and you know, it's wonderful to reinforce a stereotype. But the greatest upsurge of nationalist politics that we've seen in the last several months has actually been in Britain, with an openly racist party making huge gains. And if you want nationalist or racial riots in France or somewhere else, even in this country, I could give you examples. So I don't think Central Europe should be judged by a different standard anymore, because these things just happen all over the place. And let me just end by saying that my meta message to you would be that we simply need to do in practice what we as the West pledged ourselves to do 10 years ago when our region was joining NATO. At that time, Russia was being assuaged by a NATO statement that NATO has no plans to put any substantial forces in the region. And substantial forces were defined as two heavy divisions. But nobody imagined at the time that no forces would be put in whatsoever. And so this is, I think, the job that still needs to be done. If you can still afford it, we need some strategic reassurance. Thank you.
Thank you. On the energy security and the coordination in Central Europe, I think that again, on the perspective of energy security, you should not look onto the new member states as one group and old member states as the other group. And also we should not look from Prague that everything will be paid and secured by EU or by someone imaginative. We have invested heavily in our energy systems. And for us, the dialogue with Germany is much more important than the dialogue with Bulgaria and Romania, in that sense, because where we are. But I think that within the last year or 2 years, the debate has shifted rationally, and something has been done. It will not have immediate results, but I think we could see some improvement in energy security in our region. Also, thanks to the elections and the formation of government in Germany, where there is going to be more rationale behind the energy security strategy and policy. But, for example, we have agreed, or the companies have agreed, on the gas interconnector between the Czech Republic and Poland. And those are the minor issues, maybe sometimes not getting the front pages headlines in our countries, and of course not outside of our countries, but they are the most important once something is really happening. And I think that I hope that we will be over the Copenhagen debate soon. I strongly personally believe that the climate change debate goes against the energy security. It harms our energy security. And I'm optimistic that the Copenhagen will be very much success, and we will land on the ground afterwards, and we will treat the real serious issues and spend money on the real serious issues of energy security. I hope, I'm a little bit optimistic that it will happen. But back to the point, I don't think it is about the same lines as the old Europe and the new Europe. So with the energy policies and the different regions and different setups, it must be looked differently. And there, as I said, for us, the major or one of the major countries of the old Europe is the crucial element of our energy security system. One line on the engagement, there was a surprising, Belarus was not mentioned. We did see the U.S. administration engaging engaging Iran, handshaking with Hugo Chavez, engaging Cuba, Burma. We did see one new engagement of the European Union and European countries. That was Belarus. There is no engagement from the U.S. side. And unfortunately, this is not a sign of the division of labor. This is a sign of non-communication. And unfortunately, I think there should be something done. Because even if you look into the engagement, the U.S. engagement goes in different directions than the European Union engagement.
Thank you, Tomáš. Last but not least, Heather.
Just very quickly, three comments. On the Lisbon Treaty, I have to say, beyond this room, there's not a lot of knowledge about the Lisbon Treaty and what it does and what it will do. I think that to Minister Sikorski's point of the leadership and the selection process, I always have a phrase that organizations normally choose the leader they want, not the leader that they need. And while it was being bandied about that Mr. Blair could perhaps become the next president, and I think many of us sat up and went, oh, we know Mr. Blair, that's good. When that went past that and said, well, maybe Mr. Juncker, Mr. Balkenende, ooh, we're not sure we know those two very well. Again, I think if the leaders will define the portfolios, which will define the way forward in the next several years, and the amount of energy and time to choose those leaders and for the commissioners to develop their portfolios, I think for the next 6 to 12 months, a lot of internal energy will be understandably focused on Brussels and the organization charts. Washington is very sympathetic. We've been watching that for the last 9 months as our transition has unfolded. But I just want to caution, there's not a lot of knowledge on the Lisbon Treaty beyond sort of experts in capitals. Secondly, on Afghanistan, a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to brief several Polish journalists, and they challenged me. They said, why should we care, or why should we want Polish soldiers in Afghanistan? So I sat up a little straighter and I said, well, my argument would be recall that engagement in Afghanistan stems from the first Article 5 commitment that NATO has ever made, that the security, remember, the 9/11 plot was trained in Afghanistan and further refined in Hamburg and implemented in New York and Pennsylvania, and that the opium traffic comes through Europe as a destabilizing factor, and these are all important security issues. And they looked back at me and they went, nah, that doesn't really work for us. It's going to require great political leadership in all capitals to describe why their soldiers are in harm's way in Afghanistan. I think there's so many different descriptions. Some allies are there for the development, capacity building in Afghanistan, making sure that Afghan girls can be educated. Some were there because it was the safer war and Iraq was not possible for them politically. Others are there finding a counterterrorism, counterinsurgency strategy. And all of these agendas get more complicated as the mission becomes more complex, as the mission becomes more dangerous. So there's a lot of collateral damage if we are not successful in Afghanistan. NATO is the first one, but also the individual contribution of our allies. This will be devastating. So Afghanistan is something we must get right in concert with Europe, but I fear that there's some dangers that lie ahead. And then finally, to Minister Rotfeld's point, we have been wildly successful in this region. Yes, there was U.S. leadership, but most importantly, there was commitment by the political leadership over 15-20-year horizon to do the hard work to get into NATO and to get into the EU. But we should never be satisfied. My mother always told me never to be satisfied with my performance, to always work harder. The transition is incomplete in Central Europe. The global economic crisis has devastated some important allies, Latvia, Hungary. That economic work will continue. While corruption and lack of transparency and weakened institutions, the work continues. The work continues in the United States, where we must continue on. But we have to care. We have to care when there's anti-Roma violence. We have to care when we announce a major policy on September the 17th.
we have to care that there are far-right extreme groups in Hungary that are saying very disagreeable things. We must care, we must have dialogue, and we must act together. And my last thought and my closing thought is that the strategic drift need not be a drift. We can get this back on track, but for the first instance, the United States must care, and then from that point, we will have dialogue and we will act.
Okay, thank you, Heather.
I also would like that the U.S. cares about the situation of the neo-Nazis in Austria, not only in Hungary, if we stick to the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
We'll have a conference on these questions. We'll have a conference on these questions at some time. Okay, no big summaries. I just want to conclude by saying the message I have got from this morning's session, please, is that there is drift across the Atlantic, but it's better to drift than to sink. But it's even better to swim together in some kind of synchronized fashion. But to do that, you've got to have some common targets. And maybe we'll develop something a little bit later this afternoon. Slavik will say a few words, and then we'll take literally a five-minute break because your chairman needs to use the facilities. And then we'll go straight to Dr. Brzeziński.
Thank you, Janusz. Deficit of communication has been mentioned here several times. And this initiative has been established just in order to bridge this gap between Europe and the United States, enhance the communication between both sides of the Atlantic. And I think that this panel initiated this better communication very well. And I would like to thank all the panelists for their contributions, particularly ministers, acting ministers are very busy individuals, so we should appreciate very much their presence here. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you very much for your contribution. And I will keep close to my heart this very promising, encouraging words of Minister Sikorski supporting this initiative. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, literally 5 minutes and I'll call you back to the seat. Okay, thank you very much. Please, if you could keep your comments down, quiet. Okay, settle down. Thank you very much. I mentioned the strategic chessboard earlier this morning, so let me now give the floor to one of the longest-serving grandmasters, Zbigniew Brzeziński. Former U.S. National Security Advisor and Senior Counselor here at the Center for Strategic International Studies. Thank you very much for joining us, Zbigniew.
Thank you, Janusz. First of all, let me say how pleased I am to be here with so many friends from Central Europe, people I very much admire, and I'm delighted to see them here today. Second, let me say that I'm going to try to be relatively brief. We only have about 25 minutes. I would like to leave some time for discussion, while the subject I have been given is a relatively large one. It's strategic overview. As my point of departure, let me just make one historical observation. It's now 20 years since Central Europe has come into its own. That's exactly how long the interwar period lasted between the end of World War I, the emergence of Central Europe, and its disappearance 20 years later. And think of some contrasts. Internal political stability, infinitely better now. Security, despite some anxieties, incomparably better. Democracy, uniform, and confident. And last but not least, something entirely new, increasing unity in the region. This is a much better context, specifically, and does affect the strategic perspective. Nonetheless, I'm aware of the fact that there is some strategic uncertainty in Central Europe, particularly regarding Russia, concern about Russia's imperial aspirations, the contradictions in the post-Soviet space, the potential threat to Ukraine, the recent manifestation of a serious threat to Georgia, the quest for a sphere of privileged interest. All of that gives rise to some strategic anxieties. So let me say a few words, first of all, more specifically, on the subject of Russia. As I look at Russia, I perceive essentially two Russias competing for the future. There are two Russias, in my view, that are trying to determine what Russia might be in the years to come. The first Russia is the Russia dominated by nostalgia. Nostalgia for the past. A nostalgia rooted in the notion that the greatest calamity of the 20th century was the disintegration of the Soviet Union. A curious statement of one thinks that the 20th century was punctuated by World War I, which caused millions to be killed, by World War II, which caused many more millions to be killed, and in addition to it, the horrors of the Holocaust. It tells you something about the outlook of the people who articulate that notion. There is obviously in their mind a desire to reestablish Russia in some new form as an imperial world power. How to define it is also a source of contention within that nostalgic camp. There are the people who advocate the Eurasian concept for Russia, Eurasianism as an ism, sometimes extremely intolerant in some of its forms of expression. There is the quest, perhaps, for a Slavic Union with eyes cast in the direction of Ukraine and Belarus as the essential elements. This nostalgic camp, very much rooted in the past, is preoccupied with world status. And it focuses essentially on issues associated with it. And it had a certain impetus following the removal of the sources of anarchy in the early 90s, following the consolidation of power, following the massive inflow of external capital because of the benefits of high price of energy. It felt itself rising and riding the crest of history. But there is also another camp in Russia. There is also another perspective about the future of Russia, a perspective brought to the surface most dramatically in the course of a year ago, and particularly in the course of a year ago this fall, the financial economic crisis. That crisis was welcomed by the nostalgic camp as testifying to the proposition that the West, in the final analysis, is rotten, and that America is a big house of cards. I remember the triumphant notes sounded by Putin and others regarding the nature of this crisis and its historical implications, all implicitly suggesting that Russia was immune to this malaise. And then, lo and behold, within a few weeks, the Russian stock market collapses, outflow of capital becomes a flood, inflow of capital becomes a trickle, and a significant portion of the Russian elite feels endangered. Of the Russian elite, the oligarchs who are in close cahoots with the power brokers and the Kremlin, they are part of the political elite. And that was something entirely new. In fact, entirely new in Russian as well as Soviet history. Russia never before has been economically and financially interdependent with the rest of the world. That never happened in the Soviet days, neither towards the end, and certainly not even in the NEP. It didn't happen in the Tsarist days, the Stolypin reforms. We're not dependent on the conditions of the financial markets in London and elsewhere. This was a novel experience and a shocking experience, and an experience which brought home a sense of vulnerability. Vulnerability, but also a realization of interdependence. And that has been followed more recently by an attempt to begin to articulate the implications of this for the future of Russia. Reread, if you haven't read it carefully, reread it again, the September 10th statement, article, manifesto, whatever you wish to call it, by Medvedev. If I were to publish something like this in the Russian press, since they often ask me for comments or for contributions, if I were to publish a scorching an indictment of Russian reality using the words in that article, as Medvedev did, it would be viewed by many as confirmation of my status as a Russophobe. It was a destruction of the notion that Russia is a great power. It was finger-pointing at numerous vulnerabilities, social, political, constitutional, educational, scientific, demographic. I probably missed some elements talking from memory. But it was across the board. Together with a reform program based principally on the notion of constitutional democracy, and with 2012 not that far away, explicitly even saying that the selection of the president should be based on the competition not only of two candidates, but two political parties. One wonders what's behind these suggestions, but in any case, they are a serious statement of a different view of Russia, namely that Russia's principal task is to undo its delayed development, it is to accelerate its modernization, and it can only do so in a democratic domestic context and an interdependent global reality. That is an important statement. I don't want to exaggerate what I'm not going to mention, but indicative of it, and perhaps also as an elaboration of it, and as an attempt to create a foreign policy component of it, is a recent article in Foreign Affairs by Dmitry Trenin, which obviously leans in that direction, and read what he prescribes as a foreign policy for Russia that is realistic, that is not based on illusions, on self-deception, or on nostalgia. So we do see two camps in Russia. As someone recently said, I thought rather wittily, there is the Medvedev camp, there is the Putin camp. The only question is, in which camp is Medvedev himself? But that in many respects may be not a very important question, because the question is not really the future of Medvedev. It's the fact that Russia is undergoing a rather difficult process of rethinking what it is and where it ought to head. And it is doing so in a context which in the final analysis is neither historically nor objectively congenial to the first school of thought, the school of imperial nostalgia. Because the fact is that the larger context in which Russia finds itself is a context now very much shaped by the fact of national diversity in the space of the former Soviet Union, of the commitment to independence of almost all of the elites of the new post-Soviet state, including even the most supine or the most unpleasant, be it Belarus or even Tajikistan. The fact is that the reality of national independence in the Soviet Union, in the former Soviet Union, stands in the way of the nostalgic aspirations of the first school of thought that have dominated the political dialogue and defined what Russia is, and have been perceived as a threat, correctly, but in a limited sense, in Central Europe. Moreover, if the nostalgic school of thought were to attempt to undo the past by more than threats or economic boycotts, but by use of force, I think the likelihood is that Russia would get itself into a crisis of prolonged, enduring, and large-scale proportions. I do not believe that it is now possible anymore to redigest Ukraine, for example. Yes, there is a Russian threat to Ukraine. Yes, there is definitely the likelihood of significant Russian manipulation of the elections in Ukraine. There is, in the short run, a cause for some concern about the nature of the Russian-Ukrainian relationship. But if the Russians play it clumsily, in the end, it will be infinitely more costly for Russia, because Russia can no longer subdue nor integrate Ukraine. And hence, if it provokes something that it then cannot control, it could embroil itself in a venture which could be very counterproductive. Of course, the Russians do have the energy tool, and I don't deny its significance. It is important. But again, it is quite different from what was the case in the past. there's a difference between shutting off the oil taps towards, let's say, Kiev, or sending tanks into Prague. There's a fundamental difference, because the latter creates, for a while, irrevocable consequences. The former creates a crisis, bargaining, eventually reactions, then at some point reciprocal costs. I do not dismiss the importance of that threat, but I think if it's a qualitatively different character and one which can be then managed, particularly by a West, and not just Central Europe, but by the West, which in many respects is in so much a stronger position than Russia, that it can, in fact, bargain and deal and compete with Russia in a complicated and prolonged historical game. So while I do believe that the strategic setting in which Central Europe finds itself is complex, some of the recent alarms that I have read, including that letter addressed to an anonymous entity called Obama Administration, was somewhat overly alarming. We have a problem, we have a serious problem in our hands, but it is a problem which I believe is manageable. But there is a further aspect to the strategic setting in which Central Europe finds itself, and that is America. For West European confidence, Europe's overall confidence, Central European confidence, America is critical. And here the question is, where is America heading, and what is America's likely role in relationship to these issues? And my concern, quite frankly, is that we are still facing, and perhaps increasingly so, a growing risk of being engaged in a prolonged conflict in a huge swath of southwestern Asia, from which we may not be able to extricate ourselves for quite a few years to come. We tend to forget, with the rapidity of change, that we have now been involved in Afghanistan for 8 years. This is now the third longest war that the United States has fought in its entire history. Only the Vietnamese War and the War of Independence were longer. In 3 months from now, the Afghan War will be longer than the Vietnamese War. In 6 months from now, the Afghan War will be longer than the War of Independence, our longest war. And it could last a long time. I do not know how the situation in Afghanistan will unfold. I hope we'll avoid the extreme version of Americanizing it, because if we do, we'll repeat and also experience what the Soviets faced in Afghanistan, namely an Afghan war of national resistance against a foreign invader. But I'm also opposed to a precipitous disengagement, the consequences of which for Afghanistan and for Pakistan would be probably worse than unpredictable. And hence we have to be there, but we have to pursue an intelligent policy. But we can only do that well if at the same time we pursue intelligent policies vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which again threatens to inflame the Middle East. If we do not, and if in some fashion all three situations were to deteriorate, the United States would be faced with an engagement that could be paralyzing, totally absorbing, and probably reducing our capacity to influence in a constructive fashion the processes of political change, strategic change in Europe. This is a concern, and a serious concern of mine, because I see some forces at work in America which are making a bipartisan policy on this critical issue more difficult. Our body politic is being increasingly polarized. There are not yet two Americas the way there are two Russias, but there is the making of that, particularly in the event of some unexpected extreme event occurring in the United States, which again opens the flood doors to rampant demagogy and to a wave of public fear. We do see increasingly difficulties between the executive branch and Congress, not only on domestic policy, but on foreign policy, with massive petitions signed by congressmen designed to limit executive freedom of action or to impose legislative limits on freedom of action, and that could diminish America's capacity to act in a constructive and productive way. I hope it will not come to pass, but that to me means one final conclusion as far as Central Europe is concerned. The relationship with America is critical and important, but that relationship can only be with Europe as a whole. There's no point in Central Europeans coming to America to vent their anxieties and indirectly to imply that the West Europeans are somehow or other not very reliable or not very responsive. We can only deal with Europe, we can only respond to Europe, and ultimately we'll only listen to Europe if there is a Europe that is worth listening to, which means a Europe that speaks increasingly with a single voice, even if not a single executive officer who speaks for Europe, then a Europe that speaks with a single strategic perspective, which in the first instance, whether one likes it or not, has to be shaped by the three most important European states with something which approximates a global vocation. And that is Great Britain, Germany, and France, and perhaps increasingly in the following order, Germany, Great Britain, and France. And of course, beyond Germany and Great Britain and France, there are other important European countries, perhaps the six, if they can get together, or the five, perhaps more, or a cluster of them, if they can represent common perspectives and find a powerful voice to speak on their behalf. But to such a Europe, we'll have to listen. With such a Europe, we can work. And with such a Europe, we can fashion, I think, a constructive policy that deals responsibly with Russia. The United States does have common interests with Russia. We are going to get a START agreement that's going to be better. I'm fairly confident of that. The Russians are being marginally helpful to us in Afghanistan. With whatever strategic calculus they may have in their minds, nonetheless, but still objective, they're being helpful. They are being somewhat helpful to us in Iran, although on that I entertain some serious doubts. But nonetheless, they're still a party to a very complicated process, which should be going forward, namely the negotiating process. So we have a whole agenda, a bilateral agenda with Russia, which we cannot disregard. But we obviously have a very major stake in Europe becoming viable, in Europe becoming secure, and in the new geopolitical realities post-1989 not being undone in the space of the former Soviet Union. I do not think that Russia alone can undo them. But if the West were to move into paralysis and crisis, obviously the temptation that the first Russia is more prone to could become very strong. So an American-European relationship and a single Europe with which we can relate and a central Europe which asserts itself within Europe is something very much in our joint strategic interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Zbigniew. I think we have time for maybe two or three questions before Phil Gordon's here. Let me take the liberty of asking you the first question. Russia's struggle for modernization, in your view, can it be accomplished through some kind of a Chinese model, or does that not apply to Russia? Or in the Russia's case, does it require political pluralism, opening of society, closer links with the West in all its aspects?
Well, a Chinese model for Russia would only work if the Russians became Chinese. Quite seriously. I mean, it's just, you look at how the Chinese did it. You look at the concentration of intelligence, effort, but also personal initiative within it. I don't see Russia being able to replicate the Chinese model. I think they'll get bogged down in statism, which will not work well in the Russian conditions, as we already know, whereas the Chinese have been able to combine statism with private initiative, in large measure because of their cultural traditions and really high-level intelligence of the leadership. I have dealt with the Chinese leadership now for 30 years repeatedly. I know personally every top Chinese leader. This is an impressive group of people, and we are very serious about understanding the world. The Politburo has regular sessions once a month for a whole day devoted to some complex international issue, such as, for example, the first session they ever had was on why do empires rise and fall. The whole Politburo spent the whole day studying that. sessions on economic crises, on Keynesianism, and so forth. This is a leadership that is really alert to the world and very strategic in its outlook, not prone to extreme shift of moods. No, I think if the Russians are to become modern, they'll have to move gradually the way Central Europe has been moving, actually the way Poland has been moving. And I think this is why the Polish case is so pertinent to Russia. Yesterday at the World Bank, there was an event dedicated specifically to an examination of the Polish experience over the last 20 years, including its extraordinary success in the last year, the only sort of mid-sized, large economy that's been actually successful and continued to grow and had low inflation, growth rate, no growth in unemployment in the course of the last year. And what was clear to me from listening to Gajdar and his reactions was the extent to which a lot of what the Poles have done can still be replicated in Russia, but it will take a longer time.
Yes, I have a question. Russia is aspiring to become one of the new polars of contemporary world. For me, the problem is that Russia lacks magnetism somehow. Is it possible for the Russians to restore its magnet, to be more attractive for neighbors?
Well, to be attractive, you either have to have some extraordinary capacity for mass deception, appealing to the subjective instincts of those who are attracted, by which I mean ideology. Russia was terribly attractive as a pole of attraction when it was seemingly building a new society. People went there, looked at Russia, came out and said, I've seen the future and it works. Well, we know that it wasn't working then, and eventually it stopped working altogether. But ideology, mass deception, self-deception can be a very powerful force of attraction. There's nothing like that in Russia today. Russian nationalism is not going to attract the non-Russians. Russian imperial traditions are not going to attract the Russians. There's no idea around which Russia can become a pole of attraction. Russian orthodoxy is not going to attract non-Russians. So the other alternative is performance. That is what makes China attractive. You go to China and you see the performance. You see the new cities. You see an interstate highway system increasingly like ours. I wonder how many people in this room know that China, which has roughly the same land space as the United States, had no roads of any significance until about a decade ago. And a decade ago, they started building them. We built our interstate system in the 50s and 60s under General Eisenhower's inspiration. 65,000 miles of superhighways. The Chinese already have 42,000 miles of superhighways, like the best of ours. The Russians are building their first right now, their first, from Moscow to St. Petersburg, more or less trying to build a superhighway on the road that was built by Peter the Great. So, you know, that's a rather long period of time. You cannot drive from Moscow to Berlin except on a two-lane highway moving in opposite directions, clogged with trucks. You cannot drive from Moscow to Vladivostok except on gravel and mud. And so, you know, the capacity of the Chinese in a determined fashion to set goals and to achieve them is demonstrable, and it is impressive to outsiders. No one is attracted by China because of Chinese talk of, new Chinese socialism and so forth. They're attracted by Chinese performance.
Maybe China can rebuild Russia. But
that's what the Russians are hoping for, except they don't want the Chinese to do it.
To do it, yeah. Any other questions? We have just a couple of minutes before our lunch panel. Frontline speaker, please.
I don't know if there's a microphone.
Who has a microphone?
Marco? Please speak up. Okay.
Come to the table and speak to this one.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Michael Baranowski from the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Mr. Brzezinski, I wanted to ask you about perception of threat assessment in Washington regarding the threat of any sort to Central and Eastern Europe. And the perception of threat assessment in Central and Eastern Europe, and our abilities to deal with it. Do you see a large gap between those two, and how do we best manage this gap that, if there is one, could create some friction?
Well, I thought that was a subject I was trying to address, namely, that this so-called threat or the threat assessment is somewhat less dramatic here than one senses occasionally in Central Europe for reasons I tried to explain. I have, broadly speaking, a relatively optimistic view of the prospects for Central Europe, for the continuation of the success that it has enjoyed over the last 20 years. And I have a somewhat more pessimistic view as to the prospects of Russia emerging as a major power capable of really threatening Central Europe in the foreseeable future.
Please, Minister.
Since Professor Brzezinski said everything there was to be said, I just can't keep myself from telling you a joke that I've heard from a Russian politician and that illustrates perfectly well, I believe, the first of Russia, the nostalgic Russia. And the joke is about these two hunters who were brought by a small plane somewhere into Siberia. And when the plane was leaving, he said, "Gentlemen, I'll come back in 2 days to pick you up. But it's a small plane, so no big animals, because it's a very small plane." And indeed, he came back after 2 days, and there they were, two hunters, and an enormous bear. He said, "Gentlemen, I said, no big animals." They said, yeah, we know from experience, if we give you $200, you will load the bear and take off with us." So indeed, the money changed hands, they loaded the bear onto the plane, and they joined, and after about 5 miles, they collapsed. And one of the hunters wakes up and says, "What did happen?" The other says, "We crashed." "So where?" "About two miles from the place we crashed last year."
Should we finish on a joke, or is there any other last-minute question? Please, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Susan Cornwell with Reuters.
Can you hear
me? Can you hear me?
Yeah. Is it on?
Yeah, I hope so. Can you hear me now?
Yeah,
I'm Susan Cornwell with Reuters. You were just saying you didn't think that Russia was really capable of threatening Central Europe in the near future, but we just heard from the Polish foreign minister that he was rather concerned by this recent Russian military exercise near the borders of NATO, and he talked about how the Russians, I think he said they had 900 tanks and there were just 6 American soldiers in Poland. And I wondered whether you think, do you see a vacuum in Central Europe in terms of U.S. and NATO military installations? Do you think that it would be a good idea to put some U.S. or NATO more military installations there? Thank you.
Well, I know about that exercise, the Sub-Zapad exercise. And I think it's provocative. It's also stupid. It's very reflective of Russia, number one, the nostalgic Russia, because what does it really accomplish for Russia? I mean, what does it accomplish for Russia? What it makes more likely, in fact, is something that presumably the people who sort of organize these maneuvers don't want to see, which is a gradual increase in NATO's capacities and presence in Central Europe. Because obviously its effect is to cause, very sensibly so, in the authorities in Poland or in the Baltic republics to say, well, how about having now an exercise not called the West, but an exercise called the East? And I think there is going to be something like this, in fact, in the Baltic area. And there will probably be more emphasis in NATO on contingency planning, although some of it has taken place. But as a political judgment, as a historical judgment, I don't see those Russian forces that exercised in Belarus with the Belarusian army really sweeping westward in the foreseeable future. and by foreseeable future, I mean a number, X number of years. So it's a kind of empty political gesture, which I think convinces me even more that a significant portion of the Russian political elite has lost touch with strategic reality, to the point that it's almost ridiculous. Take, for example, the great celebration in the Russian press, and particularly in the military press, of its most recent great military victory. Now, you would think that if they talk that way, they were talking about World War II, and they deserve it, because that was a great Russian-Soviet military victory. No, they're celebrating their victory over Georgian forces a year ago, which were two brigades trained by the United States for counterterrorism activity, and which somewhat unwisely were sent into Ossetia and then were overpowered by a Russian army of about 50,000, 60,000 men that swept southward and into Georgia and, in fact, threatened Tbilisi, but which otherwise, from every study we have made of their military operation, performed surprisingly badly. It was an incompetent, messy, costly, disorganized victory, won largely by superiority in numbers, and perhaps not as quite a determined Georgian resistance as one would have wished for. But, you know, that kind of reinforcement of foreign policy with military demonstrations is, if anything, counterproductive. I hate to think what might happen, for example, if the Russians, encouraged by this kind of stuff, started to try to intimidate Ukraine. And they have begun to do some of that in Crimea. They're likely to produce a massive Ukrainian nationalist reaction. Because if there is anything the Ukrainians are united about, it's not the state, it's not common policy, it's land, it's territory. This really gets the Ukrainians going. I remind you of an incident several years ago called Tuzla. There was a little island in the Sea of Azov, which on the map was part of Ukraine, but close to it was Russian territory. So the Russians got the bright idea of sending out a lot of ships, construction ships, which started digging up stones and rocks to link the island to that territory so that on the map it would then appear as Russia, and which would give them a better access to the Sea of Azov. The Ukrainians became absolutely outraged. Kuchma, a relatively pro-Russian president, was in Brazil. He canceled his trip, flew to Ukraine, took a small plane to Tuzla, stood on the shores, and proclaimed that every Ukrainian is determined to protect Ukraine's sacred soil. At which moment, Ukrainian MiGs appeared and fired symbolically with machine guns into the sea. Kind of, you know, a message to somebody, obviously. Then Ukrainian ships appeared. This is actually why I'm telling you it's true, even though it sounds comical. Ukrainian ships appeared, pulled up to the side of the Russian ships. So as the Russian ships would dig up rocks and sand and dump it to connect Russia with this island, the Ukrainian ships would dig in, pick up the same rocks and sand, and throw it back into the sea. And this operation lasted a few hours until both sides came to their senses. In the meantime, the Ukrainian Rada held a special session. You know, the Ukrainian Rada cannot legislate anything for weeks right now because they are so divided. They hold a special session, unanimous vote, everybody, the party of the regents, the Communist Party, and so forth, that the sacred soil of Ukraine must not be touched. Now, there could be something in Crimea, but even a year ago, when the Russians sent some of their marines into Sevastopol on some sort of a task, which wasn't coordinated with the Ukrainians, the Ukrainian commanding officer in Simferopol, when there is an armored Ukrainian division stationed, phoned up the Russian naval commander and said, if your marines are not back in your ship by 6 p.m. tonight, our tanks will be entering Sevastopol. And they were back on their ship by 6 p.m. So, you know, the Russian military demonstrations are reminiscent of the past, and I can understand the Central Europeans remembering Budapest, remembering Prague, to be concerned. But I think we have to have a sense of how history has changed, how the strategic realities of Russia have changed.
Okay, very, very last question, Charles. I'll give to Charles, and please be brief.
Oh, I'll be very brief indeed. The response to the Russian military exercise, thanks to my BlackBerry here, is right here. The United States will hold first military exercises with Baltic states in 2010, either September or October or 2010. I don't know if this is in direct response, but you can make your own, draw your own conclusion.
Well, even if they're not in direct response, they'll be seen as in direct response. And what benefit the Russians are getting out of that?
Okay, on that we will rest. Thank you very much, Zbigniew. And another round of applause. I would say gather your lunches and we'll reconvene in about 10-15 minutes. Okay, last orders, please, and everybody sit down. We're going to go straight into our lunchtime session. And let me begin by saying that according to some analysts, U.S. policy priorities under the Barack Obama administration have shifted away from Europe, whether West, Central, or in particular Central East Europe. One therefore wonders what our keynote speaker does in all the spare time he has available. Joking aside, one can only admire someone who covers such an extensive and diverse area as Europe and Eurasia, especially during a time of such enormous flux, both within these vast regions and in U.S. policy towards the numerous states and multinational organizations therein. Maybe we can compare it to a three-dimensional chess game, and our lunchtime speaker today, I think, will be admirably able to enlighten us on the current state of play, particularly on U.S. policy towards this region. Let me therefore welcome Philip Gordon, Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia. Just a little background on Phil. Prior to his current position, he was Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute. Before that, serving as Director for European Affairs at the National Security Council under President Bill Clinton, where he played a key role in developing NATO policy in the run-up to the alliance's 50th summit. He has also held teaching and research posts at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, and the German Society for Foreign Affairs in Bonn, amongst others. He has published a number of books on international relations and foreign policy, and we welcome him and honor to have him here at the center. Thanks, Phil.
Janusz, thank you very much for inviting me here and for putting this on together with Slavomir and the Polish Institute for International Affairs. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I regret I missed the opening panels, which looked very interesting. I actually spent my morning at the US-EU summit, which was also relevant for much of the discussions here, not least because of the degree to which we talked about Central and Eastern Europe and the Eastern Partnership. And for the past hour, the launch of the U.S.-EU Energy Council, which I think is also relevant for our discussions today. I've been a long admirer of the CSIS Europe program and Central Europe program, with which I have worked extensively in the past. Indeed, I remember a year or so ago being at this very podium, then speaking about Senator Obama's view of Europe and Central and Eastern Europe, and I'm delighted to be back now, less than a year into the new administration, to talk about our perspectives and accomplishments and the challenges that we face together in this part of the world. This is also a timely conference because Central and Eastern Europe is in the spotlight this fall. Not only because of the many policy issues at the forefront, which I hope to discuss, including Russia and missile defense and NATO and the global financial crisis. But it's also in the spotlight because this year, of course, marks the 20th anniversary of the revolutions that toppled dictatorial regimes in the region and communism. As I believe you know, this Sunday, Secretary Clinton will travel to Berlin for the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall to join other European leaders to celebrate that anniversary, which set off such a positive domino effect throughout Central and Eastern Europe, liberating tens of millions of people. These events deserve to be recalled not just to honor and celebrate those who took part in them, but also to learn the lessons about how to get rid of ideology and authoritarianism and to promote democracy, stability, and prosperity, a set of issues that is, alas, all too relevant for many other parts of the world today. The remarks I was asked to give are about U.S. perspectives on Central and Eastern Europe, and that is what I will do. But I would like to just make one point about the overall focus of this conference, which is the question of whether U.S. and Central and Eastern Europe strategic interests are converging or diverging. And let me say, and I particularly want to do so because I think it challenges some of the conventional wisdom and perhaps some of the views that were expressed this morning here, that I actually think U.S. and Central European interests are converging and not diverging. And the main reason I say that is actually a consequence of the point or the reference I just made to 20 years ago and what has happened in Central and Eastern Europe since. That is to say that the democratic revolutions that took place in Central and Eastern Europe 20 years ago put that region on a path towards Europe and the West in terms of its values and institutions and economies and interests. And these countries are now very far along that path. In other words, we see increasingly Central and Eastern European countries the same way we see Western European countries, which is to say stable, prosperous democracies with which we cooperate extensively on a whole range of global interests. When you think about Central and Eastern Europe's strategic interests, in other words, there are some particular regional interests, but what are the main ones? They include, just as our own, coping with the international financial crisis, succeeding in Afghanistan, where we're fighting together, preventing climate change, improving energy security, helping to develop a democratic and non-threatening Russia, dealing with immigration. These are the questions the United States deals with. These are the questions Western Europe deals with. And these are the questions more and more Central and Eastern Europe deals with. Obviously, and I want to make this clear, we are sensitive to Central and Eastern Europe's enduring particular interests. Historical legacies do not quickly disappear, and geography does not change. Central Europeans still face security threats that, I think for understandable reasons, are felt with more intensity than in the distant United States. Countries in Eastern Europe have been subject to energy cutoffs, cyber attacks, political pressure, and in the case of Georgia, the use of disproportionate military force by a large neighbor. That's all clear. But my point is these are not causes for a divergence in interest between Central and Europe and the United States, because the United States strongly shares Central and Eastern Europe's interest in security from such threats and risks. And that's not only because of the rock-solid Article 5 commitment that the United States has with some of these countries, but out of our own interest. History has taught the United States that security risks in Central Europe are a threat to all of Europe, and that the security of all of Europe is a vital national interest of the United States. So I see no divergence between Central and Eastern Europe and the United States when it comes to keeping the region safe from outside threats, whether they be political, military, economic, or in the area of energy security. So that's a broad overall point I wanted to begin with, and what I'd like to do now is turn to some of the particular policy issues that I think are relevant to the region and offer the Obama administration's perspective on some of them. And I'd like to start with Russia. And I'd like to start with the president's thinking on Russia and what we're trying to do in a policy sense on Russia in ways that I think are relevant to the region. The president explained early on in the administration, and the vice president articulated it publicly early on at the Munich Security Conference, the way that we're thinking about Russia and relations with Russia. And that is to say, what we inherited was a poor and deteriorating relationship with Russia that we think served nobody. And President Obama thought it should be possible to pursue concrete cooperation with Russia in areas where we have common interests, and there are some, while at the same time agreeing to disagree about other issues where we have different interests, and without sacrificing any of our important principles or our friends. And that is what the president announced we would try to do as part of his foreign policy. It's what the vice president talked about in Munich, and it's what we've been trying to do ever since. So there was a reset with Russia announced, but it came with the corollaries that were quite clear as well, that we didn't accept the notion of privileged spheres of influence within Europe, that we thought that democracies in Europe should have the right to join the security alliances of their choosing, and that we would not recognize breakaway regions like South Ossetia and Abkhazia. The president's summit in Moscow in July, I think, demonstrated how this can work. There were some concrete achievements. The presidents agreed on a start follow-on framework. They agreed on an Afghanistan lethal transit arrangement, which is just the sort of concrete agreement in areas of common interest that we were talking about. Benefits the United States because we have more diverse supply routes to Afghanistan. It saves us potentially a lot of money, depending on how many flights there are to Afghanistan. We could save over $100 million. And there was no trade-off to get it because both countries have a common interest in succeeding. Military-to-military cooperation was reestablished to try to overcome some of the mistrust, and a bilateral presidential commission was launched with 17 sub-areas ranging from the environment to culture to allow us to pursue these common interests more institutionally. And the two countries agreed on a joint threat assessment regarding the ballistic missile threat, including from countries like Iran and North Korea. So all of that was in the basket of things where we think we can work together. But at the same time, the president made crystal clear, both publicly and in his private meetings, that our core principles still held and that we had some differences on issues like NATO enlargement and on Georgia and on democracy and human rights, which he talked about in his speech at the New Economic School and in his private meetings with NGOs, civil society, and opposition leaders. Secretary Clinton, as you know, was in Moscow 2 weeks ago and did the same thing, pursued common interests in areas where we have some and we want to cooperate, like Iran, Afghanistan, and START, nuclear nonproliferation, but at the same time making clear our differences and our determination to uphold our principles. So in short, some have questioned whether this pursuit of a reset with Russia is a sign of a diverging strategic interest with Central Europe. I think not. I think a more open and trusting relationship with Russia, where possible, and the pursuit of common interests, where possible, is actually in the interest of both the United States and Central Europe. Let me offer a couple of thoughts on the issue of missile defense, which has also, I know, been a great focus of people in the region. And I specifically want to address this issue because I think there has been a significant amount of misunderstanding about it, especially when we saw signs after the Obama administration announced its plans about how to pursue missile defense, headlines about sellouts or betrayal. And there's still talk, frankly, and no doubt there was some of it this morning, I'll just venture a guess, from critics of the administration suggesting that somehow the missile defense plan was designed to appease Russia and somehow sold out Central and European interests in the name of a reset with Russia. I'll be blunt about this. I think that line of thinking is simply wrong. We've had a chance to explain the missile defense approach. We've had a chance to explain it publicly and to our friends in the region. I actually think that understanding of what we are doing is growing, and we're getting to the point that we wanted to get to, which is people understanding that we think we have a better plan to protect Americans and Europeans from a growing threat from nuclear proliferation and ballistic missiles, but also a better plan to enhance and encourage strategic cooperation with our Central and East European partners. And that's the part of it that I think there has been a lot of misunderstanding about. Again, I think in the time since the announcement, we've had plenty of opportunity to explain this, to underscore that the factors driving this had to do with the intelligence, the realization that Iran was moving forward very quickly on short and medium range ballistic missiles, which posed a threat already to Europe, including southeastern Europe, and soon to central Europe, and then soon thereafter to western Europe, and that to us it didn't make a lot of sense to deploy 10 interceptors against ICBMs that didn't exist while leaving these countries vulnerable to a threat from dozens or hundreds of short and medium range missiles that do exist and will soon exist in much greater numbers. So that was the critique of the old plan, and the reason for exploration of a different one, which was supplemented by technological developments, namely success in the development of this Standard Missile 3 technology, which is what the new phased adaptive approach is going to be based on, in phases that will lead ultimately by 2020 to a very significant capability to deal with both short, medium, and longer range threats. And then finally, in addition to intelligence and technology, it was a policy decision. We wanted to cover all of Europe, and we wanted to do it together with NATO, rather than simply bilaterally, and that is what we're working towards as well. So frankly, we think it's a better plan on every level to defend Americans, deployed American forces, and our allies in Europe. And as for the speculation on Russia, of which there has been a lot, some have criticized us for doing it for Russia. Some have criticized us for not doing so, for not trying to negotiate or bargain something. On that, I would just simply say the reality is that Russia was an ancillary point to the points that I just made. The decision was made about how to best protect America, its allies, and its forward deployed troops. And the reality is we didn't know how Russia would respond. It was always an open question whether Russia would decide that this was more in their interest than the previous plan. They might have decided otherwise. We had no control over that. As it happens, they have been largely positive about it, which is also okay. Just because the Russians aren't criticizing it doesn't mean that it's a bad plan. Let me also reinforce the point about cooperation with Central and Eastern European allies, because I've had conversation with some friends in Central and Eastern Europe who said, actually, prior to our decision, who were saying, well, we actually don't believe in missile defense. We don't think it's necessary. We don't think it will work. But we really want you to go ahead with the plans with Poland and the Czech Republic, because they wanted strategic cooperation with the United States, which is fair enough. But the point I want to make here is, in the new plan, we think we have just such strategic cooperation with our partners in Central and Eastern Europe. Much of the focus has been on Poland, where the decision was made, of course, not to pursue the previous agreement on ground-based interceptors. But think about the current agreement, or what is on offer from the Obama administration. It was an offer, a right of first refusal to Poland, whose cooperation we were grateful in the previous plan, to deploy SM-3s if it so chose. It was an agreement to move forward with the Patriot anti-air system, indeed a more robust version that had been previously on offer, and a decision to move forward with all of the strategic dialogue and defense cooperation groups that the Bush administration had agreed with Poland in the final year. So if someone can explain to me how moving forward in basing missile defense interceptors, moving forward with all sorts of strategic dialogues, and moving forward on Patriots is somehow walking back from strategic cooperation, I would like to hear it, because we, in fact, think it's moving in the opposite direction. And we have also, with the Czech Republic, engaged in serious discussions about how they might be involved in the new plan and about moving forward with our strategic and defense dialogue with the Czech Republic. And finally, the new plan will offer other opportunities for Central and Eastern European countries and all NATO allies to be involved in what will be a much more NATO-ized missile defense plan. In short, far from abandoning Central and Eastern Europe, this phased adaptive approach to missile defense should be seen as a sign of enduring commitment. Let me say a word about our perspective on NATO and how it relates to the region. We think that NATO enlargement to Central and Eastern Europe has been a historic achievement of Democratic and Republican administrations since the end of the Cold War. I'm proud to have been involved in that process earlier in the Clinton administration and to continue the process in the Obama administration. In 1999, we, of course, welcomed in Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary to the alliance. Since then, under the Bush administration, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia have all come in, and Croatia and Albania in 2009. This really is a historic set of achievements that has contributed to stability and prosperity throughout the region, and we believe that the door to NATO enlargement must remain open. Applicants need to meet demanding criteria, but if they do, they should be free to fulfill their Euro-Atlantic aspirations just like those who preceded them. There's also the issue of NATO's strategic concept, which, of course, is being revised this year for the first time in 10 years. And there's a great debate about whether the focus should be on Article 5 or if it should be on global engagement or on new threats. And our answer to that question is simple. It needs to be all of the above. It's not a choice between focus on Article 5 or focus on global engagement. Obviously, Afghanistan is important. The alliance is at war. We're at war there together. There are more than 30,000 European troops as part of ISAF, including many troops who are making important contributions from Central and Eastern Europe. That is a core part of what NATO does in the 21st century. But that doesn't mean that Article 5 doesn't remain central, and we need to make that clear in the strategic concept and in the reality of what we do on the ground. President Obama has said that NATO must have contingency plans in place to deal with new threats wherever they come from, and that task needs to be reflected in the strategic concept, and that's what we're seeking to do as it is revised. Let me just mention a final issue, because I want to make sure we have plenty of time for your questions and comments, which is the wider Central and Eastern Europe neighborhood. I mentioned that this morning and yesterday in the extensive discussions as part of the US-EU summit, the Vice President, the President, and today at the State Department, many of these issues were discussed. Stability in Ukraine, prospects of engagement with Belarus, the hope to integrate the Balkans into Euro-Atlantic institutions, our desire to bring stability to the Caucasus. And in the course of these discussions, we expressed our very strong support for the EU's Eastern Partnership, which is in many ways a Central and Eastern European brainchild, with the Czechs, the Poles, and together with the Swedish presidency, providing resources and engagement with Ukraine, Belarus, Georgia, Moldova, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. We strongly support this. It is a reflection of a process that we think needs to move forward. The extension of democracy and stability to Central and Eastern Europe, as I said previously, was a huge bipartisan success over the past 20 years, but that process is not yet complete. And we look forward to working with our partners in Central and Eastern Europe and throughout the EU to bring those countries in the Balkans and in the Eastern Partnership closer to Euro-Atlantic institutions if they so choose. There are many other issues that we could address. I haven't said much about the economic crisis that we have been working together with our partners to deal with, and the U.S. has contributed to tackling through our stimulus plan and support for international financial institutions. We could and should talk about energy security, which is another central concern of the countries in the region, and I'm happy to discuss any of these in the discussion period. But here in conclusion, I would just say that I think and I hope that the perspectives I have offered on the issues I have addressed, Russia, missile defense, NATO, the neighborhood, underscores my initial point, which is that U.S. and Central European strategic interests are deeply entwined and converging. Thank you very much. I look forward to your questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Phil. Phil can stay for about 15 minutes, so we'll have time for some questions. Let me jump in with the first one. And let me just say that actually, surprisingly enough, missile defense was not mentioned that much this morning. We didn't really discuss it in any detail. And I don't think anybody realistically or rationally views the new system in a negative light. I don't think so. The question I have is, in terms of the positioning of planning and positioning of the system that's now on the table, what role both will Central East Europe play, but also what role will Russia play? Because there is a possibility, and I think it may already be happening, that Russia may well start to criticize the new system, not because it's a threat to Russia, to Russia's strategic arsenal, which has never been the case even with the Bush system, but because it may deepen military and security cooperation between the United States and the Central Europeans. So what is the role of Russia in this?
It's a good question. There are many levels of that. First, as I said, we didn't know how Russia would react even to this system. It is quite plausible that Russia's main objection to the Bush administration's plan based on ground-based interceptors had less to do with the technology and the type of interceptors than with the places that it was being planned to deploy. And so one wondered, what if you proposed deploying a different missile system in the same places. And essentially that's what we've done, because we made clear from the very start that we would go to Poland and express our gratitude for the previous cooperation and express an offer, a right of first refusal to deploy the new technology. It was quite possible that Russia would just simply say the same thing. We don't want to. We're not going to accept anything deployed in former Warsaw Pact countries or in Central Eastern Europe. They didn't. And as I said, that's fine with us. If this facilitates cooperation with Russia on other issues, we're certainly not going to complain about that. At the same time, we're going to, and the president has made clear that what he was doing was deciding on a missile defense system, best place to defend Americans and their allies. So we'll see as it develops. It's possible that that the Russians will, over time, raise objections, but that's not going to determine the decisions that have already been made or decisions that will be made in future, which will be driven by how to protect Americans and their allies. The other point I would make about Russia is we have said that we remain open to missile defense cooperation with Russia. We think Russia is also threatened by nuclear proliferation and ballistic missiles, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to work together on missile defenses that would protect them as it contributes to the protection of Europe as well.
Great. Thanks very much. Okay, let's start with a question. Lukasz was first. If you could reintroduce yourselves to Phil.
Of course. Lukasz Kulesa, Polish Institute of International Affairs, Warsaw. And the question is about one thing that you have not mentioned in your introduction, which is the Russian proposal for the new security architecture in Europe, so-called Medvedev's proposal. And we hear from Moscow that 2010 could be the decisive year to move forward with this issue. Of course, also taking into account the fact that Kazakhstan is would be chairmanship in Germany in office at the OSCE, and the Corfu process is going on. So my question is, what's your assessment of the current state of the discussion, and what do you think would be the future of this whole idea? I mean, needless to say, when the Russians are talking about the Helsinki 2 or Helsinki Plus, it implies that we have a very bad situation in Europe, and we need to secure what we're having, and we have two blocks, as strange as this may sound. So what's your assessment on this one?
Thanks for raising that important issue. We have said from the start, from when the Russians first raised this, that we remain open and ready for serious European security discussions with all of our all countries across Europe, including Russia. If they have issues that they want to discuss, we don't want to reject anything out of hand. We are open to dialogue and discussion. Institutions can always be improved. There was a war in Europe in 2008. Nothing's perfect, and we should remain open to serious dialogue. That said, we also made clear that in terms of institutions in Europe, we already have some pretty good ones, not just NATO and the European Union, but the OSCE. And in terms of Russia's pitch to have a comprehensive security dialogue, well, that's what the OSCE is for, in part. And we have insisted that that discussion take place within the OSCE, which is a comprehensive organization. And everyone gets a voice, and that's where we should have this discussion, and that's where we have had this discussion. We have also said that in terms of principles for European security, we also have some pretty good ones of those, too. And many of them are enshrined in the Helsinki Final Act. Non-use of force, respect for borders, territorial integrity, sovereignty, peaceful resolution of disputes. And we don't really see the scope for inventing new principles. And we're skeptical about the need for a treaty enshrining new principles, which would, of course, be difficult to enforce, even if you could negotiate and ratify it. So that's where we are. We have also insisted, the Russians keep wanting to talk about hard security, which is fine. We need organizations and institutions to talk about hard security. There is a CFE, an existing CFE treaty, from which they have suspended participation. And we'd like to see them come back into implementing the CFE treaty in terms of hard security. But we have also underscored that European security is not just about military issues and hard security. It's about human security and things that happen within borders. And that's another of the great merits of the OSCE, is that it recognizes this and it focuses on the human dimension of security and what happens within borders. And we don't want to decouple those two. We're happy to talk about all aspects of security, but we don't want to abandon those important dimensions in the OSCE and go off and have some other discussion. So these discussions do go on at the OSCE. We're happy to continue that process, but we do remain skeptical about the prospects for a treaty. And we think there are already some pretty good institutions and principles, and we should get on with the business of improving those institutions and implementing those principles rather than trying to invent new ones.
Okay, thanks very much. Charles, I saw you next.
Thank you, Phil. I was very pleased to hear what you just said a second ago about human security. For most of the people of Central and Eastern Europe, much of this discussion would be all but irrelevant. They are not concerned about NATO. They are mildly concerned about Russia. What they are concerned about are domestic issues, such as the growth of intolerance, the extraordinary effects of that intolerance on the Roma, growth of anti-Semitism, etc. My question is, aside from OSCE, is there anything in a bilateral way or through existing institutions, actually, some innovative way by which we could influence the course of politics in these countries? I realize this is not particularly the forum where you would discuss intervention in the internal affairs of sovereign states, and I don't ask you to do that. But in general terms, is there anything that you're thinking about that might help the situation there?
It's an interesting question, Charles. Look, I mean, your first point underscores my first point, which is that increasingly Central and Eastern Europe faces similar challenges to Western Europe and us. I mean, these issues that you mention of democracy and intolerance and internal struggles are not unique to Central and Eastern Europe. I mean, look at Western Europe on some of the same questions. Look at us. So, whereas I don't... fair enough to say that for the average citizen, issue of NATO and Article 5 is less relevant, although I want to underscore, I still think that these issues are relevant in the region, and certainly leaders and even publics pay attention to them. Increasingly, you're right. The day-to-day bread-and-butter issues are these others. We're certainly not in a position to, lecture on these things. We have that was, again, the point I made, that we all are facing similar challenges about how we improve democracy, multi-ethnic societies, and tolerance. All I can say is we need to do that together. I don't know if there are any special initiatives, but that's what, the European Union is good at that. The OSCE plays an important role in the human dimension. And we need together, as true partners with similar values, continue to focus on how we can improve our societies in the United States, in Western Europe, and in Central Europe.
Please, you're next.
Yes, my name is Tudor Ulyanovsky from the Embassy of Moldova, and thank you again, Assistant Secretary of State, for your support for our country, especially after the elections that we had, and all, and even at the highest level, including the Vice President, Secretary of State, and yourself, of course. Just two questions, two issues. The first one is related to the Vice President Biden visit to Europe, especially his remarks in Bucharest with regards to the fact that the U.S. is supporting the Euro-Atlantic aspirations of countries, including like mine, like Moldova, when they are ready. When at the same time, having in mind your previous remarks with the strategic patience for Georgia, and how do you think that the best reaction of countries like Moldova should be on receiving these positive signals, of course, and encouraging signals in the context of a more assertive Russia, if it is clear. And the second issue is with regards to the larger European security context, and I'm happy that you mentioned the CFE treaty. Just in general, and you, what are your expectations of the upcoming December OSCE ministerial conference in Athens? Thank you.
Okay, well, first, thank you, and thank you for being here and for your comments. One of the things I learned or discovered or experienced in my 6 months or so in office is there are a lot more challenges than sort of things that we can celebrate. and yet Moldova is actually in that latter category. We were delighted to see free and fair elections take place and a government come to power interested in joining Europe and the West and emphasizing democracy and the values that we share. And that's why we have indeed gone out of our way to try to underscore that and applaud what took place in Moldova and make sure that others see it as well. Because this is really what it's all about. It's the demonstration effect that, yes, actually, if you do the right thing and you embrace democracy and respect human rights, there are rewards for doing so. And we're going to do all we can to bolster and support the new government in Moldova financially and politically to demonstrate that. It's important not just for Moldovans, but we hope it will also be a message to others in the region. Because, as I said, there is still, when you look out, you know, at countries that haven't or haven't yet joined the EU, Ukraine, Belarus, Bosnia, Serbia, Caucasus, others, they need to see, too, that there's a reward for this. There's a benefit from doing the difficult work of overcoming ethnic divisions, accepting rule of law. And, again, I applaud what Moldova has done, and we're going to do everything we can to continue to support it. And I think that that message is relevant. You know, you talked about strategic patience and the lessons that other countries can learn. There are positive consequences for doing the right thing. And that's the story of the past 20 years, and we need to continue to make it the story of the next 20. We're looking forward to the OSCE summit or ministerial in Athens. Secretary Clinton believes strongly in the OSCE. She wants it to. She wants American engagement with the OSCE to expand. She unfortunately missed the last ministerial meeting because she broke her elbow. So this will be her first opportunity to go and work on the issue she cares a lot about. And it's a great platform for her because she has long underscored and emphasized the importance of the human dimension of security. Trafficking, human rights, and the OSCE summit in Athens is going to give her an opportunity to underscore that. Of course, we're going to participate in the Corfu process and talk about broader security issues, but I would underscore that what she's looking forward to is going and emphasizing the human dimension, and Athens will provide an excellent opportunity to do that.
Jim Lowenstein. Phil, would you say a few words about Bosnia? What you think? What do you think the danger is of an explosion?
Well, just to clearly address the last point, I don't think Bosnia is on the verge of an explosion. We experienced, obviously, horrible developments in Bosnia prior to the Dayton Agreement. And you never want to be complacent because you never know. But that's not what we're thinking about when we look at Bosnia today. And yet, what we are seeing when we look at Bosnia today is at best stagnation and at worst regression in terms of its political development. And it's relevant for the discussion we just had of positive consequences from doing the right thing and negative ones from failing to do so. And I'll be blunt. That's really the message that the United States and the European Union together, in the form of Foreign Minister Bildt and Deputy Secretary Steinberg, who've been to Bosnia twice now in the past month, that's the message they carried with them. They brought, because we saw this stagnation in the political prospects of the country, and because we feared that with elections coming up next year, if we didn't take some initiative now, we would miss another opportunity and an electoral cycle. It would be set back even further. United States and the European Union together, and it has to be together, because if we're divided on this, then the message to the parties isn't clear enough. Together we would come to offer a package, a reasonable package, indeed a modest package, that would allow them to fulfill the conditions to transition from the UN Office of High Representative to a European Union Special Representative. And what does that mean and why does it matter? It means that they can get on the starting line for membership in the European Union. And that would require them fulfilling those final conditions, resolving the issue of how to divide up state property, and taking modest steps towards a more functional government that could, as I say, get on the starting line for membership in the European Union. One thing that all Bosnians can agree on, and they disagree on many things, is that they want to be part of Europe. And we should do all we can to help them on that path. Ultimately, the choice is theirs. And that's the point I made about positive consequences and negative consequences. Other Balkan countries are on that path. Some of them are further along than others. With the agreement between Slovenia and Croatia today or yesterday, depending on what time zone you're in, that process is moving along for at least one of them. And others are on that path too. And in many cases, they're doing the right things. And our message to Bosnia was they can also be on that path, but they can also be left out. I mean, there's the choice really is up to them. We hope that they will agree to this package so that they, with the rest of the Western Balkans, can start moving towards Euro-Atlantic integration. And we're doing this very closely with our European European partners.
Very last question, lady over there, please. That's you. Grab a microphone, because Phil has to run in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, hi. I'm Susan Cornwell with Reuters. This morning, the Polish foreign minister said that Central Europe needed some strategic reassurance. And he talked about this recent Russian military exercise, Zapad, and said that he thought maybe there were 6 American soldiers in Poland. So I'm just wondering how you think you can provide Central Europe with this strategic reassurance. Can that be done with more military hardware, installations, exercises, or how?
Mm-hmm. I think we have to do so. I mean, if something, reassurance is in the eye of the beholder. If people say they need to be reassured, then they need to be reassured. And it's our job to do what we can to reassure them. I don't think it's simply or even mainly a military question. The military side is important, and that's why I emphasized Article 5, and that's why I mentioned our military and strategic cooperation, and that's why I mentioned missile defense and other aspects of military cooperation. But I don't think that's the core of it. I think that Central Europe wants to know that we care about the region, we're integrated with the region, and we define it as part of our interests. Again, that's the first point I made, and I said that we do. That should be reassuring to Central Europeans to know that the United States is paying attention, values the partnership, and we can always do more, and I think that was the message the Vice President carried with him when he went out there a couple of weeks ago, and it's a message we are going to continue to carry. And it is one that, as I said, the cycle of 20th anniversaries provides us a good opportunity to do so, because we can talk about what we have together achieved, how important it is to us, how it can be an example to others. And we are going to work. We realize that there's a perception out there, because the United States is appropriately focused on Iran and North Korea and Afghanistan, that Europe or Central Europe doesn't count as much as it used to. But I think, you know, the president has been to Europe more times in his first year than I think any previous president. I mentioned the vice president going out, and all of us are going to continue to show up to demonstrate that we see Central and Eastern Europe as a core part of our alliance and a very close partner of the United States.
Great. That's a good note to finish on. Thanks very much, Phil. Great job. We're going to take I'm going to say 5 minutes, which will mean 10, but let's say 5-minute break, and we'll reconvene for the next panel. Thank you.